This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Wrestling Indies International. I'm Pete. I'm with Timothy. Timothy, man, what's going on, brother?
Oh, same old, same old. Walking wounded a little bit here. Missing out on hanging out with a good friend of mine this weekend who happens to be in town. Because I don't know what the fuck happened, but out of nowhere, my foot, the bottom of my foot just started hurting like hell the other day. So I was having trouble walking around. It's feeling a little bit better now, so I'm less worried. I was thinking, felt like it was getting worse and worse, and I was worried about, like, maybe I should go to the fucking doctor and get it checked out because of how bad it is. But I'm feeling better now. I've been watching some wrestling, which was nice because I had the day off yesterday. Took the day to get caught up on some stuff that I've been slacking and behind on watching. How you been, though, Pete?
Doing good. I just got back from a scenic city, man. That was a thing. A lot of fun. A lot of great wrestling. Got to be around a lot of great people, met a lot of great people. I can't put it over enough. Yeah, Tim, you really need to get your ass out there. I don't know. Did you see that tweet? I shamed you.
Someone
wrote that on the ticket.
I saw it. And that was probably, it was probably a smart move because, yeah, that was the moment where I made my decision. I got a little bit of a bonus coming through here in about a month, and I think I'm going to squirrel away a chunk of that cash to make sure that I'm making it out next year. Because I think I just have to at this point. It's getting ridiculous that I haven't been able to make it out there with how much I've loved the SCI and how much all the fun sounds. It was really funny because I was having a conversation with a friend. I'm like, so many people, I think, the social event of the year for indie fandom would be Bola, which I've gone to, every year for the past however many years. But for me right now, it feels like the big social event of the year is the SCI. So I got to get out there and meet up with all the good brothers that I've been talking to on the internet forever and haven't actually got to meet in person yet.
Yeah. I'll give you a little breakdown. I get into town Thursday. We go out to pizza. I think there's about 14 of us. Then we go, we'd have some drinks. Then we go to a bowling alley / game place where the goal was we were going to go play all these games. First, originally on the agenda was we were going to go see a baseball game, but the weather, we weren't sure about that. And so we didn't do that because we didn't want to go and get rained out. So we did the dinner thing, and then we did this, but we ended up, because we're all a bunch of lushes, none of us played games. We all went to the back bar of the bowling alley. There's one girl, about 12 or 14 of us. So she had to wait on our jabroni asses, and we drank there until we closed that place down. Then we moved over to the karaoke place. Bar at again, and drank heavily and mightily and stoutfully, and some of the guys did karaoke. Not my thing. I'm more of a watcher than a singer. I save that for showers and for big time things I got to do. But I'm just not a big public singer. Then we had night two. I think we started out at the pool that afternoon, drank some more. Then we went to the SCI that night, and they had a great night one. I mean, it was off the charts. And the big injuries going into that tournament, right, Tim, with Matthews and Gunner?
Yeah. I mean, in the last minute replacement.
And I'm also assuming, I haven't heard, I didn't ask, but I'm assuming Riddle was also part of the plans to be booked for that show, since he won last year and was in, the last 2 years. So I'm assuming their whole entire creativity, creative, probably went on Red Alert because they had to rebook this thing. And this was a master class of booking night one to get things going and to set things up. And once you watch it, we'll discuss it more in detail about the matches. So I don't want to go in to detail on all the matches. But I'll just say they were all very good, all different, all well-booked. And just little things that I you know, gives me a smile on face. It makes me proud that, you know, you have people you know or you support a product you're proud of. Like, you know, we've been watching the G1, and they've been doing a lot of brawling. We've seen how they've abused officials. But you know what? They just let them do it. There's no consequences to it. Well, you know what? In the main event on night one of Scenic City was Carry Off on Nick Gage brawl, right? They got out on the intercom right before that match and said this was referee's discretion. You know what? That one line allowed the ref to allow them to be outside they didn't have to follow the 20 count. The ref could be a little loose with the rules. Just a one booking suggestion idea just changes the whole entire dynamic and doesn't leave a bad taste in your mouth, which some of these G1 matches have with me on some of those things. I mean, yeah, I think I've been pretty vocal about the G1 and the refereeing and the beating up of the refs and making them look like shit and interfering right in front of the refs and not doing anything about it. You know what? If they would have said, hey, ref's discretion, it's something I could buy in because at least that's in the forefront of your mind. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, completely. And I think we talked about it, but the storyline angle here where they're trying to, like, play up some places they're doing ref disqualifications and then other places they're doing the exact same stuff and there's no DQ also really hurts the credibility. So when you have something where you say this is specifically this match, there's a reason that things are different, it makes a lot more sense. And again, we mentioned it with Kevin Kelly, but it's a little bit better than Kevin Kelly trying to just say, oh, this crowd would get so mad if Suzuki got DQ'd. Yeah. You know, like, I get that he's trying, and you can't blame the guy for putting some effort, but, you know, that just seems like such a cop-out.
Yeah, he's making, yeah, Kevin Kelly, you can't blame him. He's making chicken shit out of chicken. He's making chicken salad out of chicken shit. If that's what he's given. At least with throwing out that thing on the intercom, being announced to the crowd, it makes a big deal. Now they had some glitches, like night two, there was a finish, and it was under Mansur rules, and they kind of forgot they didn't announce that, so the finish didn't come across. Everyone was confused at the finish, where I even had to ask Mance Warner what. Explain the finish to me when I was having beers with him later, because I didn't understand the fucking finish. I'm sure he loved that. And then there was another one where they had Nick Gage and Hollis had a hell of a brawl, and they were supposed to announce something, and they kind of forgot it because I asked about it. But at least the effort was there. And then it was explained to me later. But yeah, night one booking-wise was just absolutely, positively tremendous. And later that night, it was considered Scenic City Prom, right? And that was an absolute a shit show. I mean, it was just out of control, drinking. I don't know. Did you see Nick Gage's tweets about it?
Oh, I did not. I try to
okay,
stay away
Nick
from
Gage
this.
Was saying it was like the most. He doesn't know what the fuck he was watching. What is he doing in this place? And this is a guy who's done prison time, and he's utterly disgusted on what he's seeing here. You know, I'm able to block things out, and I wasn't paying too much attention. I was sitting right next to Nick Gage, so I did not. I wasn't paying attention, but from what people told me afterwards. I was just having a drinking, and I had a guy who was, I forget the dude's name, really nice guy, really interested in, really a big territorial wrestling fan, so he was just picking my brain, so I was more in line, talking to him, and so I really didn't see what all the debauchery that was going on by the dance floor, but I guess there was a lot. I heard... There was like table dancing, big guys dancing with guys, girls dancing with girls, freaking doing people doing the worm on the dance floor, along with a lot of other stuff. But I had a blast. I was just having beers and shooting the shit with people. And Nick Cage came up to me. I forgot I was wearing a Matt Riddle's Blood shirt. And he had gone up to my buddy Josh Allen earlier, and he's like, "Man, Miller Lite, that's my favorite beer. I'll take two." And then, of course, Josh gives him two beers. And he comes up to me later and goes, "Man, that's a kick-ass shirt." I'm thinking to myself, fuck, I hope Nick Cage isn't going to tell me he wants my shirt. But I looked down and I forgot I was wearing a Blood shirt. Shirt that he was fucking wrestled on, and we talked about the show for a bit. And then night two begins, and we get up early for the wrestling Q&A, and old Papa Hales is in full worker mode trying to get wrestlers down for that. I think one of my favorite lines was I was shooting the shit with Kane, and Papa Hales asked Kane to come down and sit on the thing, and he goes, "And Pete, wouldn't this be great for Kane's career?" total working, total full fledged fucking worker. Papa Hales going into there, and so we did the wrestlers Q&A that morning. And then right before then was the hot dog eating contest, and that was disgusting. Watching people watch me eat hot dogs, I came in third. My boy Ben, my boy Ben. Either way, I haven't pronounced his damn last name. Freaking kicked ass, took first place, but there's an asterisk by him because he's on the insulin pump. That gives you a little edge. It's like being on the gas in the Olympics. But hey, I'm not a sore loser. I'm glad he won. Of all the guys, I'd rather lose to Ben. I came in third, but it felt like I was like a gorilla in the zoo where people are just watching you. It was very uncomfortable. I've been uncomfortable would describe my when I was dropping my hot dogs later on that evening. About 4 hours later, it was terrible, terrifying. I'm never doing that again. Then we got to the future shows, and a guy we've talked about on here before, where it's up, but Marco Stunt was the big breakout player of the future show. He's a guy who's gonna, that's the coolest thing about Scenic City. It's becoming kind of like a NFL combine because people are getting bookings straight off this. Ike Cross got a couple bookings off it. Marco Stunt, along with a bunch of other guys. And because people are a lot of promotions are there watching this thing and they're seeing, hey, this guy's a talent. He's a talent. Like me and you, we watched Ike Cross, right?
Yeah.
We thought he had potential, but man, you don't get it until you see him live. You don't realize, you probably didn't realize how freaking handsome the guy is watching him on tape, do you?
No, and I've heard he's a lot bigger, too. I was like, I did not realize he's a big guy, good looking, and I didn't realize how long he's been wrestling. I thought he was a rookie, and he's actually been wrestling for about 4 years already.
Okay, yeah, you don't realize how strikingly handsome he is and big. I mean, he's the ultimate babyface, and he got over huge, got bookings. He worked with some great talent, don't get me wrong, and put him in the right place to shine in the sort of the tournament. And he worked hard. I mean, he worked hard. I don't want to take anything away from him. Some things you don't pick on tape. But even like Marco Stunt, I remember us both being impressed with him on tape, but you don't realize that the dude's 4'8". Has a shit ton of charisma, and it just doesn't play on tape as well as it does live. And that guy got over something fierce. Just amazingly.
He's got a good look right now, especially, I think, because he kind of reminds you of one of the kids maybe from Stranger Things or something.
Yeah, he does.
But I was thinking about it today, and I'm like, God, if he, you know, we put a mask on him, he could be another Rey Mysterio as a guy who can have that kind of that charisma for his entire career. I wonder what's going to happen as he gets older, if his face ages, if it'll affect that same level of charisma. But in ring, I mean, yeah, there's something there. He's got a charisma right now that's really good, and I just hope that he can make something of it. I saw Twitter blowing up a little bit with Janela looking for someone to stick into a spot fest, you know, ladder match, and everyone I can see of any note was saying, you know, he was the guy to pop in there. Yeah, and I'm on the same bandwagon, you know.
Yeah, the dude's 22 going on 14. That's my catch line on him, and I think it's a good one. The guy has it. Yeah, he doesn't. I mean, he looks so young. He went out to pizza with us night one, and yeah, and my Ben Ben recorded him getting ID'd. Everyone. I was getting ID'd, but. The fact that he, like, there's no way he's 22, but, I mean, I got to serve him. it was, yeah, he got over huge. And then we took a breather, ate some dinner, and then we went went to night two. And that, I mean, it topped night one. I thought night one was going to be a hard show to top because, I thought the booking, I mean, we'll review it, but the booking was brilliant on night one on setting up all this stuff. And then night two happened and they had, I mean, everyone I've said, most everyone I've talked to loved the Joey Lynch PCO match was their favorite. And I liked it a lot. I mean, I gave it like 4.25 or something. But my favorite match was War Horse versus Gary J. I thought that thing was everything you want in a wrestling match. And they did some cool booking with that because they got Gary J's elbow over. And we'll discuss it. I don't want to spoil it without people watching it. I'll spoil who won it because that's out there. But I don't want to spoil finishes on matches. I was just on the Place to Be main event. I didn't want to spoil finishes because it hasn't aired yet. But they get Gary J's elbow over as awesome as a killer move again with good booking. I those are just two matches that really stood out to me, and they were both fantastic for different reasons. Joey Lynch got over as the dude who could wrestle, he could brawl, he's a Southern baby face, he could go move, he can go high spot with you, he can go strike for strike. The dude really can do it all. I'm sure he needs a little bit of work on his promos, but other than that, in ring, the dude has it all, and he has a charisma about him. It's a very Southern babyface charisma, and it's just wild. It's just cool watching him grow in each of these last few years in the SCI, and this year he finally toppled the mountain. In an excellent, excellent show. I can't wait for you to watch it. And then we went to Sup, and again, I don't want to go, because we're going to review it on this, so I don't want to go in and spoil you on stuff, but I will say there was an Alley Cat Samantha Heights match, and Samantha Heights really impressed us on the Making Town Classics, right?
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. She was really good on there.
Yeah, I mean, because I mean, I didn't know her, really know who she was going into it. Have you ever seen her live?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, I'm there, and I start booing her, right? And that girl starts booing me back. And of course, everyone's laughing in the crowd because there's a lot of, you know, SCI guys from the there. And I'm like, I can't believe I'm getting fucking booed by this girl. And so at the finish, I go, that's what happens. Mean girls never win. And she goes, neither do losers, jerk. And gave me the fucking finger. It was great. Absolutely great. And the main event was Can't Miss. We got our first really pure comedy match was here at Sub. There was... I mean, there was like some ha-ha jokey stuff, but this is straight-up comedy, and it worked in spades when, you know, me and you talked about it, man. Sometimes if you do it, like, when you don't do it all the time, or when you haven't done one straight comedy match, really, in three days of wrestling, and you finally do one, it gets over like gangbusters, and Nick Iggy and Effie did one, and it was tremendous. I mean, we got dick pics, and you know, I'm your daddy, I'm your granddaddy, just a lot of it was funny, man, and hope it translated as well as it was live, because it was a blast. Because, you know, I used to complain about Wrestle Circus. Sometimes they'd book a show with Colt Cabana, what's her name, Leva Bates, you know, and we'd either, you know, they would have like three or four comedy matches. It's like, are you kidding me? Don't you get it? You need one is enough. More than one, you're enjoy Ryan on the same show. You know, it's like if they're not booked against each other, you're fucking, it's a disaster. Here was one, it was protected. The main event was brutal, and the closing angle was about as heated of an angle as I've seen live since the days I was going to Territorial Wrestling in Houston, or maybe like Boss Man putting the chain, putting the handcuffs on Hogan and beating him up at a house show finish to set up a cage match type stuff from the 80s. And that's a huge compliment. The way this thing was done was incredible. The heat was nuts. I really do hope it translates well on tape, because the heat was nuts in the building, I will tell you that. And these are all shows, they're all fun in their own way, and tremendous, and everyone involved with both promotions should be really proud of themselves. Okay. Anything else you want to talk about, Tim, before we get into this?
No, not particularly. I just want to get into the reviews here.
All right, man. Let's start off with night 11 of the G1. Opens up with Makabe and Fale. You know, this is fun, Haas moments early on. Then, of course, we get some interference early. I enjoyed the Haas spots in it, but the multiple interference are kind of like, eh. I end up giving it 2.25. You know, I mean, on paper, it doesn't scream out like match of the year contender or anything like that. So they didn't play down or play up, I don't think. It was just a match on the G1 of guys who really people aren't really invested in. What did you think of the match?
Yeah, I liked it less than you, and the shtick and everything with Fale is just getting really grating at this point. So I gave it 1.5. You know, just not much there. Yeah, like everything you said, there was some good stuff. These guys can go at it, but Makabe, I think, is at the point now where I don't buy into him at all. Even when he has some good stuff, I just don't get into it because he's done so much bullshit. That, like, even his kind of Haas-y battling stuff, he's just lost his credibility with me almost completely. So it's hard for me to get into him.
Totally, I can totally understand that. What do you think of the next match? Ethan Page, Hangman Page, and Jay White.
Coming out party for Hangman Page. This whole tournament we talked about, I think this is the match for me that really stood out for him in a lot of ways, becoming a star in Japan. The back selling, the back work from the knife pervert Jay White was pretty good. I loved the selling from Page. I loved the big spots from Page. Good job of not going over the top. Really great spot for the buckshot lariat no sell. You know, it's a no sell on a spot, but it's that buckshot lariat, so not a big deal. With White going seamlessly into that deadlift German right back on the neck, and I loved that Page, even taking a big German like that on the back of the neck in there, he was able to kind of transition it to where it was believable to come out of that still selling the back like that was an attack on the back even more. You know, because I mean, a German suplex can get you flush pretty much anywhere in the back of your body. Head and shoulders, neck seems to tend to be the spot, but you know, before people used to throw suplexes and actually have people land flat on their back. Not anymore. It doesn't seem you want everyone dumping on the top of their head nowadays. But yeah, I thought
yeah,
that
they like shortened careers and guys who need
yeah.
to be eating out of a with a spoon for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I thought that there was some really great action in this all around. Great selling, really good. I mean, getting Paige over, which I don't know if that's like the plan is to get him over as a babyface. I guess he's aligned with the Bullet Club that's now kind of being pushed more babyface with Kenny and Coda in it. So it is like kind of acceptable for him to be a babyface there, with that situation with the whole situation going on with the whole group. So I gave this 3 3/4. I really loved, like I said, the selling, the drama, the way that Paige continuously was fighting, looking for his big moves while remembering to sell that back, hitting some nice big high spots throughout the whole thing. I just really, really good stuff from both guys here. I mean, honestly, probably both guys' best match of the tournament, and really solidifies Jay White as the heel, and I think really puts Paige over as a babyface that you see the crowd can get over, kind of in the same spot that Juice was by the end of the tournament last time, or, you know, last G1, where he came out of it feeling like he could be a, you know, upper mid-card mix babyface kind of guy.
Yeah, and then they kind of killed it here this year with Juice, huh?
Yeah, I would say Juice is not quite as exciting this year as he was last year. That's
yeah,
sure.
You know, yeah, I totally agree. I'm with you, man. I thought this was Hangman Page's best match of the tournament, and I think it might have been White's, too. I gave it 4. I thought it was a great physical match. I thought White with nasty the snap into the rails by White. White destroying the back. Big time selling by Paige. And the guys had really great chemistry here. And Paige's top row bump is nuts and should never be done again. That thing off the top rope he did. Absolutely fantastic. And I haven't heard a whole lot of people talking about this match. And I was like kind of disappointed. Because, you know, we've heard about all the other ones that, you know, Meltzer's been raving about, but this one wasn't one that that Meltzer, you know, put gas on. I thought it was tremendous work by both guys.
Yeah, and you know, it's in a kind of in a bad spot. It's right, you know, it's the second match on pretty much the middle show of the G1. It's in a place where it's kind of meant to get lost, but it is depressing when it gets overlooked because of how good it really was.
Yeah, totally. You know, something I was also thinking about, I mean, you know how they use Yano a lot. They've been using Yano to open the shows a lot. I mean, if I was booking, I would have him be booked as the third match because I'd have two solid ones or two good ones first, get a breather with the Yano match, and then go and then close down the show. But they're doing completely different. I get it, but... do you think Yano would be more effective or his matches might actually get over in the middle there?
Yeah, I agree. I think Yano, Fale, even, you know, to a lesser extent, Tama Tonga, those are the guys that should be kind of the middle of the pack matches that get, again, subsumed or overlooked. And the opener for the G1 action, obviously, because there is more to the shows that we're completely skipping, but the opener for the G1 should be hot and get people excited so that they realize, oh, this is the G1 matches. This is important. Instead of opening with the especially we talked about it before. I get driven so crazy, like especially tournament, you know, kind of setting shows that are predominantly tournament stuff. When you're getting, you know, non-tournament matches, breather matches that are starting the show, opening the action, or you know, back-to-back-to-back breather matches, where I'm kind of like, you should be really parsing that stuff out to where you get the optimum effect, which is breaking up the kind of the story and not necessarily opening up or, you know, that kind of situation. So yeah, I'm totally with you on that.
All right, well, let's keep on going. I'm sorry for sidetracking it, but I thought it was an interesting talking point. Minoru Suzuki versus Evil. Gave it 3 stars. Fun fight. Again, a chair right in front of the ref. I laugh every time an announcer calls the finishers a lot of times. And I mean, I'm not just these guys, but it's just so funny when you're like hearing Juice promises going for Juice Box or Evil, Fear No Evil, or whatever the fuck the finishing names are. They're absurd, these names, you know? So every time they start teasing their finishers and Kevin Kelly goes into the big cell, oh, it's the juice box, he counters juice box. Oh, it's almost like ridiculous how obnoxiously stupid some of these finisher names are. Oh gosh. I just couldn't get over some of that stuff. Just a good fun fight overall. And 3 stars. What about you? What do you think?
Yeah, I went 3.25 with you on pretty much everything. I'm impressed by Evil because he's able to be the heater and the big man for the Ingobernables group. That's kind of kind of leans heel. They're cool heel or whatever. But he's also able to really seamlessly play kind of more of an underdog babyface in a role like this against someone like Suzuki, who's looked at as like a big evil, who's you know a bigger bad guy than him and malicious and whatever. So I always kind of get a kick out of that from Evil with his ability to take his character and work it on both sides, because that's pretty impressive for a guy with that character, where he doesn't to me lose a lot of credibility as a heater being able to do that. So I give him a lot of credit on that. Especially like I've talked about his size and everything. So a guy who's able to do both roles, switch like that, keep credibility and not, you know, kind of exploit himself too much, even when he sells and kind of bumps underneath for someone like Suzuki, is it's impressive the way he's able to, he just has instant credibility, instant legitimacy to everything he does. He talked about it. G1's when he first came back, that, Darkness Falls, Near Fall would get huge pops every time. People would buy into it no matter what. There's something about Evil. The guy is just, he's really fucking good. I think he gets a comparison to Goto as a kind of like, he may be the always a bridesmaid, never the bride type of guy. And I could see that, but it feels like a major waste. I mean, similarly to Goto, honestly, it feels like a major waste because he's a guy who can get over, who the crowd can buy into no matter what. And, it can... could definitely be used for more. We'll see what ends up happening with Evil. I'll be interested.
He's only really into year two with the gimmick.
Yeah, exactly.
He reminds me a lot of Hashimoto. So, is very high praise because Hashimoto was the man. And was an incredible worker. But if I was Evil, I'd be watching a lot more Hashimoto tapes and trying to ape some stuff from him, especially the aura, because Evil could have that aura.
Yeah, no, that's for sure, and he has a fire and a stoicism that I think a lot of guys we talk about in New Japan, especially Sonata, Okada, they have that stoicism, but they don't necessarily are able to translate the emotion and the fire as well as Hashimoto or I think even Evil can do, honestly. So, moving forward, I think that could be because that's, I think that is something that gets overlooked for Japanese kind of top guy ace, what you consider like baby faces. I think Tanahashi has it for sure. But like a guy like Okada, I think it gets overlooked. There's an underlying burning and emotion and passion, even if they are a little bit stoic. And Tanahashi obviously is not very stoic at all, but he does have really good underlying fire at all times. And I think that someone like Okada, someone like Sonata, I just don't see it. And I think that it gets overlooked because they're like, oh, well, he plays that kind of stoic top babyface role really well. But you miss the fact that like I don't have the depth. I don't get that, you know, that burning underneath that you need for me to be able to invest as much in. So I think Evil, you talk about that with Hashimoto. I think Evil has a very similar, or could have a very similar effect in that regard. The brawling and stuff is, yeah, it's really trite and overdone, the chairs, all that. But the opening, the finish was really good. And I like I said, I really like Evil's flexibility. The guy deserves a lot more credit for how well he can play a lot of different roles.
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy they have set up for Jericho next, unless they're going to do a rematch with Naito, but it looks like they spun it out where maybe Evil gets a shot at him, so we'll see how that plays out.
What do you think of Tanahashi versus
Yoshihashi?
I mean, this is more of the reason why, Tanahashi ends up where he ends up in the tournament, I'll just say, and the reason why he's like, probably one of the best performers from this year's tournament. I mean, this is, Yoshihashi's best match. It felt like Yoshihashi turned it up here. The selling of the arm is good, but again, I just talked about it, the underlying fire. I really felt more coming from Yoshihashi here, and that comes from the credibility of Tanahashi. It's like, this match matters. More than any other G1 match, this match matters. because beating Tanahashi means something big. And being able to show that you're, you know, at his level or better, even at his age, even at his placement, you can feel it coming off of Yoshihashi the whole time. You know, the way he's trying to essentially, you know, outdo Tanahashi, both great selling back and forth, both with the arms kind of in neck areas, both, you know, kind of going the whole way through. Nice big bombs from Hashi. Like I said, Yoshihashi felt like he turned up the intensity in a lot of ways, not just with his facials and his selling and his aggression, but also with the moves he's using, the kind of the pace that they're cutting throughout. Like Tanahashi switching over to the kind of selling the leg from missing the high fly flow. Always good spot from him. I like, just all around great stuff. Great near falls. Crowd going wild for the whole thing. Like I said, Yoshihashi's like best performance through the tournament, just to show how good Tanahashi really is. Tanahashi gets that sneaky kind of flying armbar into a cradle pin kind of situation to steal one while still selling the fuck out of his neck and just the knee, and he's just all banged up, but he's the crafty veteran who's able to pull it out. And the post-match stuff even adds a lot to this match in how good it is. Still with everything there, I mean, 3 stars, you know, a really good Yoshihashi match is still not like a top-level thing to me, but really good work here from both guys, honestly.
I liked it a little better than you. I gave it 3.5. I like how Yoshihashi focused on the neck and back. The game changer was Tanahashi with the dragon screw. Tana misses his high five flow and dings his knee. And I absolutely loved like the flash finish to everything here, which was great because I felt like it was part of the story they were telling. Totally dug it. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was I agree with everything you were saying because it did. It was like Tanahashi just being in the same ring just elevated Yoshihashi. That leads to Okada versus Elgin. I thought this was a great match. Okada's DDT on the floor was nasty, but you know what? Elgin pretty much pops up. If this was 1986 WWF, Steamboat would have done a stretcher job to Jake the Snake's DDT in the same exact thing. But that shows how things change. Presentation of wrestling is different. I love the draping DDT by Okada on the floor. Okada dropkick to the neck. Feels like a big-time Okada title defense here. Elgin using his power moves. I loved Elgin's near falls. Really good stuff. I thought they matched up and meshed real well. I thought they had good chemistry. And 4.25. What are your thoughts?
I think a little bit lower than you. I mean, I went 3.75 here. And I'm with you. I think that my issue, why I liked it less, was because of that kind of that opening stuff. It really felt like you set up, you start out, and you got kind of a little bit of a knee issue going on with Okada. He's selling the knee after the attacks from Elgin, and then he hits that first DDT on the floor, then the second, and then it feels like that's just gone. And it was like the whole point of those was. Which I like, actually, as the basis and the foundation for the match, but it felt like you could have skipped the knee stuff in the beginning, as, you know, really the foundation there was that it took kind of those big DDTs on the floor and the attacks from Okada to now even it out somewhat so that Elgin's power could be mitigated a little bit, which I guess was kind of the point of the opening, was to show that Elgin's power game was gonna could overpower Okada and put him down, but then those big, you know, attacks on the floor and then working over the neck subsequently afterwards is what made it so Okada had, you know, kind of a basis for being able to get the better of him in the end. But yeah, it just felt like a little tacked on for the start, to be that, to then set up what was naturally going to be kind of a lot trading back and forth, big spots. Good work in there. Good selling from both guys, really. But I think we'll get to a match later with Mike and Fale. And it was kind of like, God, this is perfect. Like Fale's or Mike's selling and everything. I just wish that he wasn't doing the same level of selling for everyone. It made sense in the context of Fale. And I understood with the attacks on the floor, like you talked about. But it felt like almost too, like you mentioned, it almost feeling like too much. And then from there, it feels like then Mike is just selling the whole rest of the match as if Okada is at the equal level with him. And it's kind of like, well, I mean, if it's that, if those DDTs and those attacks were that bad, then it almost should have been like a big stretcher job or something like that. It felt like he gets up really fast, but then he sells it for the rest of the match. And I just feel like there's a dissonance between the two sides of that to me.
Gotcha. Now we're on night 12, and we get Ishii versus Tama Tonga. What are your thoughts here?
God, I don't even want to fucking review these Tama Tonga matches anymore. Like,
I know, man, right?
There's good stuff from Ishii here, for sure. And I kind of liked them playing with the chairs. I hated when the seat completely fell out of the chair, and then now they're still hitting each other with it, because just the chair frame like that, to me, while I know getting hit with a pipe or like whatever that is like that would hurt like hell, it also doesn't have the same, I guess, concussive blow to me that makes it believable as like a game changer. It's like, you know, getting whacked with a stick versus getting hit with a brick or something. You know, it's like, it would hurt for sure. It would sting, but it's something I've always had a little bit of an issue with wrestling, which is that there's attacks that to me come across like that wouldn't actually put you out to where you would stay down, but it's treated like it would, because in the context of wrestling, you have to get pinned to lose. And it's like, you know, cumulative levels of getting hurt. I don't know. It's just that. So that really kind of takes me out of it. And I understand that, you know, the chair just fell apart. It just falls apart. Bullshit, whatever. Fuck. I mean, Ishii was trying, but, you know, even still, it's like, I feel kind of bad. Cause like, you know, not I feel bad, but I, you know, both of us don't really care that much about Ishii. So I think for other people, Ishii's working here and his selling and everything that he does could probably save it. But for me, it doesn't. I gave this 1 star.
I give it 1 star too. And I thought Ishii's had a great tournament, but yeah, this sucked him down. Why the ref didn't DQ Ishii is beyond me. What a clusterfuck. I mean, I know we weren't ones who said Tama Tonga is a hidden great worker. Do you think this G1 exposes that fucking talking point?
I mean, I said that I thought that there was a possibility that he could do something. But I always thought that his issue was going to be more his character and charisma, but it feels like that's gotten over. And what they're doing, I feel like the storyline is working to cover. But the thing about that talking point is that the people making it, I feel like, are, I hate to say this, but somewhat disingenuous to begin with, making the fucking talking point. So it doesn't really matter how much this proves that he's not that great. They're still going to say it because they just want to believe it because, you know, it's New Japan. And hey, I don't fucking know. I mean, he's obviously got some kind of connections or something, and people who are getting something about what's going on backstage at New Japan are getting it from somewhere, you know. So who knows why certain places have always put Tama Tonga over so much about how, oh, I bet he's like actually a great worker. But you know, it could be related to that, to being one of the gaijin who's been there forever, who's maybe been continuing to give people information, you know, about what's going on backstage and all this stuff. I don't know. I mean, you know, whatever. It feels like Lance Archer didn't get the same level of praise for the stuff he was doing in New Japan.
And Lance,
you know,
Archer's a much better worker than Thomas.
Yeah, exactly. We've seen kind of exactly
much
my point.
Single matches in the G1 years prior, and he's fucking terrible, Tama Tonga. I mean,
yeah.
I hearing these talking points that have been going back 3 years that if Tama Tonga got the chance, he'd show what a great worker he is. It's the fucking dirt shit. I mean, the fucking worst. I mean, he's worse than Yano fucking.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Yano is actually good. I mean, like, I this mean, whole tournament, fuck. Yano has had good matches. Like, yeah.
Oh, shit. All right. Then we got Sonata versus Juice Robinson. I like this. I give this 3.5. I really love Juice's arm drag here. Counters of counters early on. Sonata on the arm. Big moment was Sonata tweaks his knee and we see Juice working a bit. Just really good, smart work. 3.5 stars. What were your thoughts here, Tim?
Yeah, 3.75 for me on this. I really like that, you know, with the presentation that Sonata has had, we talked about that he's treated as if he can out wrestle and out grapple and out fly and out everything, everyone. This match was great because it put Juice on that level, and felt like it did a great job of getting Juice over coming out of this. Really liked the action back and forth. The big punch from Juice to set up the finish, I thought was really, really cool little spot, and just good all around stuff. I mean, these guys, super, super talented, both guys, really. I mean, Sonata's a guy who I don't get into his matches, but I know he's really good. And with a guy like Juice selling and bumping for him, it really helps to put him over even more. So, yeah, and with the credibility that Juice has built up now, or not Juice, but Sonata has built up, being able to kind of use that to help put over Juice is, like, really, really good. So it's kind of like I question why they put so much equity into Sonata, but then when you kind of cash in on it in a situation like this, like, it makes it realize that it's kind of worth it. But at the same time, you still kind of question, you know, what the plan is with him. But yeah, we'll see. I mean, he seems like a guy who can definitely work to get people over. I mean, he did a good job here. I mean, not that, you know, Juice needs a lot of help getting over. He's very over. But this was really good stuff between the two of them, between these two.
Totally agree. And that leads us into Naito versus Yano.
I really liked the opening stuff with Yano being the one who wants to get into the match. Really felt like the violence from Naito was good here. I just wish that it could be translated into more. You know, here I thought that some of the stuff Naito was doing was less goofy and more, you know, ruthless and violent, the attacks that he's doing to Yano, which, with Yano being kind of the beloved comedy clown babyface, I thought that that could get over Naito strong as a big-time heel, but it really feels like coming out of it, there's no difference in Naito. And that's really one of the biggest issues, I think, with Naito, is it doesn't matter what he does or what the situation is, he's the same, he's exactly the same, he's the same character, people are into him the same, people really, really love him for, you know, for a reason that I don't necessarily always 100% get. His matches can be very good, but they can also be insanely samey. He can also come across really lazy. Honestly, I mean, a huge comparison, especially even with the, you know, the Mexican charisma influence, is Naito is really turning into the late stages of Nakamura. Where, like, yeah, it makes sense that he's not winning the big title. He's not being given the IWGP title, similarly to, you know, putting Nakamura with that IC title for a long time and all that. He's a good guy that can draw crowds for the B shows, but I don't necessarily know if he's a top-level guy that's going to get you attraction from, you know, casual and outside kind of mainstream fan types. So yeah, because he feels like while he's very over and his gimmick really works, he doesn't grow, he doesn't change, and there's no real depth to his character. It just is what it is. And that's why I say, like, the violence that he was inflicting on Yano in the beginning could have helped to then make him seem like more of a heel moving forward throughout the tournament. But instead, it just felt like something that he happened to do in this match. You know, obviously he gets the win, whatever. I gave it 2¾ star, honestly, and it was like, It's been an interesting dynamic this year to, like, kind of point out who's having good matches with Yano, because Yano is having actually good matches, but it shows, like, where you're at as a wrestler in New Japan based on what you're doing with him. It's like, if you're having good matches with him, that's because you're putting some extra thought into it, and if you're not, then it's, you know, kind of because you're just doing, like, trying to just do paint-by-numbers bullshit.
Yep. I'm with you. I gave it 2.5. That was fun, and it was really all it could be. That's all I really want out of a Yano-Naito matchup. Then we got Zack Sabre Jr. versus Omega. I was really looking forward to this, and it just didn't happen for me. I still liked it. A lot of slapping earlier, battling for positions. Like Omega's urgency to fight Zack's submissions. But it doesn't seem like they've had better. You know, 3¾. It just seemed like they looked like they both had different agendas, if you will, in the match. And didn't completely click with me. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, very similar. I think these are like some of the very few, and I'm kind of aping a sentiment from QT Quentin that I read him saying after I had already watched the match, which is that these are two guys who are really more meant to have a longer epic type match. And they could do a lot better having more time, just more drama, more stakes, everything built up a little bit more. This match would have been a lot better. I gave it 3¾ as well. The opening stuff was good. You're right. I thought that Omega did a good job of conveying that there's something for him to be afraid of here with Zack. I think that the booking and the setup and the commentary all do a good job of kind of making that. I think everyone going into this match expected this to be the spoiler, the chink in the armor for Omega, because, you know, going into the final night, I think we would all predict that you expect the final night is going to be Ibushi versus Omega, with the tournament being on the line in that match, or the, you know, the block being on the line in that match. And that Zack would be the guy who makes the most sense to be the one to give Omega his first loss here. And set it up so that you can have the ability to have that match have some drama so that Omega doesn't go into it completely undefeated still. That said, I think playing off of that did a really good job to help build up the drama. The submission holds on the ramp, I thought, were a great little touch. It shows the viciousness from Zach. It also kind of adds into the storyline as that. I don't know. There's just something stupid about that. You know, the Walls of Jericho on the announce table hurts worse. There's something about the ankle work on the ramp that makes it feel bigger because then you've got the selling of the leg and you got to take that. It's probably because you got to take that march back to the ring with the bum leg. So you get to really see in a long stride just how fucked up Omega's leg is there. But then, yeah, he comes in from that after some really good legwork, and relatively quickly afterwards, he's doing, you know, flying spots and big dives off the top rope and posting and countering into big suplexes and stuff. So it kind of, while Zach did transition into arm work later on in there, it does, it's like, God, what happened to your knee? It's just completely gone because now you're selling the arm. It's like, it just becomes so like video game. You know, it's this bad thing to say about Kenny Omega, right? Everyone likes to say it, that he's a little bit video gamey, but it's like, it's this idea that he can only sell one body part at a time, you know? So it's like, once the arm is the thing getting worked on, then his leg is back to 100%. I mean, I'd like to have just seen him keep selling it a little bit more. Good drama.
Yeah, he's like, honestly, I mean, I like a lot of what Kenny does, don't get me wrong, but I also think he might be the least subtle wrestler on the planet.
Yes, and this match was where I hate to say it because I don't want to turn into just one of these, like, Kenny haters that's just like, oh, he's the worst and all this, but
right,
his facial expressions are starting to wear on me to the point where, like, if I just see his over-the-top face sometimes that he makes in certain situations, it instantly is taking me out of the match now, and I really fucking hate that because he's been one of my favorite guys forever. I mean, since we've been doing this show, I've been talking good about it, like, so much about him. I mean, how many shows in a row from New Japan did what I say saying Kenny Omega had the best match on the show in some fucking junior tag, you know, junior title defense or whatever, and talk about the history that I have with him, but it is starting to wear on me to the point where I am kind of like, ah, oh, geez. You know, I can't even look at his face without getting taken out of the match a little bit. Even though everything else he's doing has actually done a pretty good job of toning it down. I mean, there's no cold spray bullshit in this tournament. There's no, you know, flagpole in the butthole, none of that stuff, but even just his face. That said, he goes back to selling the knee towards the end. I really liked the finish with him sneaking out with the cradle win. Zach is really selling the pissed off that he does. I mean, Zach is really good at this hot temper thing, and I think that, you know, that's something to expound on a little bit more later. But he does a good job as being the guy who's got the hot temper that'll cost him a match and cost him a lot of stuff in that regard. So, you know, good action. Like I said, I think that these guys, given a main event slot with, you know, 40 minutes, I think they could actually even have a better match, which is not something I would normally say, but I think that these two, that would be the case.
Then we close up this night, 12, we have Ibushi versus Goto. What were your take on this?
This was weird for me, especially having it be the main event over the Ibushi's, or the Omega Zach match, because I really kind of question why Omega as the champion feels like a lot of nights he's not main eventing the shows, especially, you know, under Ibushi, and I get that, you know, probably because they're trying to help build up Ibushi. This was good. I think it's a good matchup for Ibushi to try to help build up some credibility with his background as a kickboxer or whatever, that he can have a nice kind of slugfest with Goto. But I look at Ibushi and I just don't see it, no matter how much I know his background and his, you know, his fighting style being kickboxing and all that, that Goto just seems bigger to me. He is bigger. He's thicker. Goto has the history of being in these kind of wars. So for me, I think that they shouldn't be presented as equals when it comes to striking and brawling kind of off. And I think that Goto should have been treated more like he was the bigger striker and that Ibushi was going to need to use. I mean, he does show off some of his high flying and his flips and stuff like that. And I just think that he should have used it a lot more to be, that's how he's getting advantages. I think throughout the match, he's throwing big strikes. He's able to pick up and throw Goto around a little bit easier than he really needs to be. And it kind of hurts it. But that said, I mean, the selling and the drama back and forth from both guys is done super well. So for I guess a match structure that I personally find flawed, I think that they executed it very well. And it's like, if I was predisposed to buy into Kota at a kind of Goto's level for strength and striking and everything, then I would be even higher on the match. But because I'm kind of not, and I still to this day really think of Kota more as a high flyer type, who has some strikes. I mean, for me, a lot of his stuff, I never really kind of thought about his credibility as a striker coming up and watching him throughout. So I just never, you know, I just don't necessarily get super into that as his deal. That said, I gave the match 3.25. It was good action. It was good back and forth. It was good drama. But like I said, I didn't buy into it as much because I just didn't buy into the story that they were trying to, or not the story, but the dynamic that they were trying to present between the two wrestlers.
Fair enough. I'm with you in a way. I gave it 3.25. I thought it was a good match, but it just lacked something. I mean, I can't even put my finger on it. It just, again, it could have come down to chemistry. Or they just didn't mesh. And I mean, it wasn't a terrible match. It just, I think they just had issues working it. And that's what I felt. 3.25. It's not a bad match, but just for the main event, it was pretty rough. Then we go into night 13. And we got Elgin and Fale. I was enjoying this. Tongaloa set up the heat early. But if Elgin gets payback, Fale out, out-bigging Elgin. Fale destroys the arm. Arm work, very, very basic. And then we, Elgin's comeback was fine. I gave it 3.25. I enjoyed the chemistry and the bigness to the match. What about you?
I'd probably be higher, honestly, if it wasn't for the kind of the interference stuff just grating on me at this point. But that said, I gave it 3 stars. This is what I was talking about. I really liked Elgin selling for Fale here. The arm work, everything was done really well. And this is how I want Elgin to sell, only in matches with people that are like the size of Fale, you know? And
right.
The thing that hurts it for me is that he sells like this for everyone. And then feels the need to kind of show off his flying game and what else he can do, where I think like he should really save that for only these settings. And that said, I mean, it's kind of shitty to penalize this match because of being an example of what I wish he would not do in other settings, but it working perfectly here. But, you know, that said, still, there was all the interference bullshit and just too much going on, really. But yeah, I mean, you know, not bad. Good stuff, realistically, but just a lot more bullshit from Fale. And of course, that's the way it goes. But Elgin, I thought, looked really fucking good here, honestly. And, like, a good showing of what Elgin can do in the right settings.
Cool. And then we lead into Maccabee versus Hangman. What do you think of this one?
I mean, you know, Page tried his damnedest. His fire, his fighting from underneath, what he could do, he did really well. You know, kind of showing off his strength, being able to deadlift Maccabee up, I thought was a really good spot and gets him over, continues to get him over. But I talked about him kind of being set up to be a perfect babyface in the Jay White match, and then it felt like here, I mean, you know, Maccabee is really over and everything that he's got. It felt that he was a little bit, I don't know, I guess the posture was supposed to be kind of just two ass-kicker types, and I think that just didn't quite work to me with just,
yeah.
Paige's alignment is just off because of the Bullet Club thing where I'm sure that the Bullet Club is that he's involved with now is our baby faces in New Japan, even, you know, not even just in, you know, ROH, but in New Japan too. But there's something to it where I still don't completely buy him as a baby face. And so a little bit of the stuff that he's doing on top, trying to be kind of, you know, that showing that he could stand toe to toe brawling with Maccabee comes across a little bit heelish to me, where I feel like after that Jay White match, he should have been presented 100% as a plucky underdog baby face. And
yeah,
that kind of hurts it for me. I thought he should have probably fought underneath for most of this match and got some key spots with some, maybe using some of his speed and some flying instead of showing off his power as much. Yeah, I just, you know, and it's Maccabee. So that's also going to always be part of a Maccabee match, is that he's just a step off in a lot of ways. And he gets presented in a way that I don't buy into. That said, I think it's a good win for Paige to pick up, makes him look good coming out of it. But, yeah, I gave this, you know, 2.75-star.
Yeah, I went 2.25. I thought both guys had nice suplexes in there. But really, it was just, you know, it's hard to work with Maccabee, man. He's a load. And that's kind of what we got here. So we did it best by throwing suplexes around. Then we got Jay White versus Yoshihashi. I like this. Big suplex by White early on. White just throwing the back. Nice suplexes by White. Love the setup in White's Low Blow. Yoshihashi come back right after the Low Blow. I thought was odd and made didn't make sense to me. But overall, it worked, and I gave it 3.25. What about you?
I gave it 3 stars. I thought that this was a good match to show Jay White, again, kind of developing more into like an evil heel. And I think he's doing a good job of kind of having that, being kind of sinister with the stuff that he's doing, especially setting up the Low Blow, like you said. He's coming into this character really well. That said, Yoshihashi really didn't give me much here as a babyface underdog kind of thing. Good action, good kind of back and forth work. The character stuff was there. Everything was really there. But just a really solid match. And honestly, I mean, for the way that this G1 has been going for the most part, it's like this was really middle of the road type stuff from them, or for the tournament.
What you make of Tanahashi versus Evil?
Evil turning up the heat here, being more of the bad guy. Like I talk about, the way he's able to switch back and forth, I think is really, really impressive. The arm work from Evil I thought was great. Love Tanahashi. I mean, he is the master of the tit for tat. If you work over Tanahashi's arm, he's going to go after yours. So I love the selling from Tanahashi on the arm, and then he's got that. It's just, I don't know how to describe it, but it's like it's a nice thing where even though he's a babyface, he's got this kind of punitive kind of characteristic to his style that I think works, because it's not taking shortcuts, it's not being shitty, it's just that, like, it's an eye for an eye, and it's about fairness. So you work over his arm, he's gonna work over yours, which is good stuff. Loved the near fall selling of the count out. I thought was good. Tanahashi comes back in, really nice solid looking strikes, big flopping and flying bumps from Tanahashi for Evil, which I thought was impressive. It's always impressive the way that Tanahashi can get up and get around for his age, and not just his actual age, but the age that he is in ring years, just because the wear and tear he's put on his body. You talked about the Dragon Screw before, but the Dragon Screw leg whip being Tanahashi's big kind of transition setup hope spots, and the thing that'll always cause the like kind of transition of the match is good. Love Tanahashi going for the high fly flow miss and selling the arm out of it. It's like a lot of times when you miss the big dive, it comes up, it's always just the knees, but you can land on your arm and tweak your shoulder and everything else too. So I liked that, to play up the arm work throughout the match. Really good focus from Evil, honestly, on the arm. It really felt like never really lost that focus throughout the match, which was good. A lot of times it feels like they kind of go back and forth and don't really stay focused, but good stuff from that. Tanahashi with one of his kind of out of nowhere finishes. You talked about it in the other match with the cradle, but it's something that works good for Tanahashi. I think I like, he doesn't need that big, long near fall back and forth. He doesn't have to hit his finisher a dozen times in a row. He just kind of hits his finisher, gets the pin, and it's over. 3.25 star though. It was good. It was really good, honestly, but it didn't get into great, amazing territory for me.
Yeah, I went 3.75. Evil destroying the arm, targeting the arm, huge bump from top. To the two won by Tanahashi. Missed the high fly flow. Yeah, this is telling a great story. I went 3.75. Enjoyed it tremendously. Then we got Okada versus Minoru Suzuki, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought this was excellent. I went 4 stars. Thought this was hard-hitting, smash-mouth wrestling that I kind of grew up on. I like that type of stuff. It didn't need to go blow into a big finish, which I'm glad I didn't. What we got, though, worked, and they worked in spades. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, 3.75 from me. Didn't need a lot of that brawling in the crowd bullshit, but when they're in the ring, they're having really, really good match. I questioned this being the main event until it was actually happening. Then they did a really good job of building it. Really stiff, nice strikes. Feels like Suzuki makes Okada earn everything, really, which is nice because, he's that older vet. And he's really never been the top of the mountain in New Japan, but he's got that kind of chip on his shoulder. Like, he thinks that the younger guys don't deserve the spots that they have above him. So I really like that. All in all, really good action.
And then we got open up night 14, and I got you got Goto versus Tama Tonga. How were your thoughts there?
Tama Tonga. But Goto did a good job with him, honestly. And I thought that Goto's selling here. Goto is, I mean, he's turning into a guy who takes nights off, which he used to never be. But he was here for this, so I give him some credit. The selling, the fire, again, he's got that intensity. God, I mean, now thinking about it, we were talking earlier about the comparisons between Evil and Goto, and then, you know, it's even there too with that. The fire intensity from Goto, I think Evil mirrors in a lot of ways that helps. So hopefully, I mean, I don't know, maybe Goto could have been a top guy too. Who knows? Either way, good stuff. But, I mean, Tama Tonga, in a match like this where Tama Tonga's kind of just plugged in and doing some spots with a guy who's selling and going back and forth with him, he could work, he can be okay. That's the thing, is I think that his mechanics are really there when we talk about Tama Tonga as a worker, but it's just, it feels like the stuff in between the moves and the kind of the logic and storyline of the match is not there, and then it hurts him a lot to, on top of that, have this storyline where all he's doing is, you know, the ref getting pulled out of the ring, Fale attack, you know, Tonga Loa attacking in the middle of the match. It's getting good heat because it's the only, you know, it's the only matches that it's happening, and I did like the spot with Goto trying to fight off Fale. I think that could have even had him, you know, pull it off, but whatever. Then the ref just says, fuck it, and throws the whole thing out. I wish that we could just throw Tama Tonga out of the tournament. I gave it 2.5 stars.
I gave it 2.25. I thought it was a nice payoff to all the interference. So it worked for me on that level. But again, you know, it was what it was. Then we got Zack Sabre Jr. versus Juice Robinson. Both guys are throwing strikes to start. It's getting hot really early here on. Early, Zack Sabre begins to torture Juice's arm, and he's just doing it, and it's just destroying Juice. Juice's arm is just dog shit at this point. The crowd is really getting up for all this. Juice with his nasty chops. Zack Sabre Jr. counters an off Zack Sabre's counter of the spine buster is great. Amazing finish. I give it 4.25. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm pretty solidly with you there. I gave it 4 stars. I thought the Juice really, I mean, the facials, even in the beginning, the anger and the kind of way that he was looking at Zack as he's trying to fight him off and just kind of knowing what he's got in store for him was really nice, especially with his hurt hand, and he's just got a pissed off kind of demeanor throughout the match, and then in between that, selling his ass off as he's just getting fucking destroyed by Zack. Nasty fucking finish with Zack just wrenching the guy apart into a million pieces. Really great stuff all around. Fantastic action from both guys. Really gets both guys over, honestly, coming out of it, even with Zack kind of looking pretty dominant. I thought that Juice really brought the fight to Zack, and I loved that a lot. And I talked about Zack's kind of hot-headedness being his downfall, and I thought that they're doing a really good job telling that story here. He can get hot-headed. He can even do something as stupid as try to brawl back and forth even with Juice here, just because he gets caught up in the moment or the emotion. But you got Takahashi on the outside to play off, saying that he's the one keeping him in line and reeling him back in when he gets a little bit too worked up. And I think that that's just a perfect, you know, kind of dynamic to have with him right now. Great match, great action. These guys are just phenomenal together.
And I skipped Sonata versus Yano, sorry. But it was fine, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, fine.
Let's just skip it. I forgot that match. I have it written up on my top of my page in real small print. Then we got Omega versus Ishii. What were your thoughts here?
Oh, this was fucking phenomenal. These guys are so good together. I mean,
aren't they?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. We talk about Ishii when he can kind of do his thing, when he is in the right setting. He can have great matches. But yeah, I mean, here, him and Omega, I don't know what it is. I mean, Omega, too, he's another guy who's got his issues. I think that Ishii, for me, is a guy who has almost no, 3.5-star match. Like, his matches to me are either, in the 1-2-star range, or they're, 4-5-star. Like, the guy is just, he's, no middle ground for me. It matters about when it clicks. That's when it clicks, and it's really good. And then otherwise, I'm just bored by his same old stick over and over again. But, yeah. The way that Omega plays off of him, trying to fight him and just can't, and it, I mean, you know, so many people do the same shit with Ishii, but something about when Omega does it, the fire, the passion, everything that comes back and forth between the two is great. The way that I think that Omega sells for Ishii more than anybody, and that's also what helps make his matches for me. Because he bumps around and is just kind of gets the shit kicked out of him by Ishii the way no one really does. Most people would rather beat up on Ishii, and I think that's part of what makes it work. Is that so? Then for me, by the end of the match, I'm built into the credibility of Ishii as having beat this guy up so much that I can buy into like kind of the big finishes and everything that's going on at the end.
Yeah, this is where Ishii's like selling really plays well into it, because then he gets beat down, beat down, beat down, and it matters. You know, you get behind him.
Yeah, exactly. So. Good, really, really good. So I gave it 4.5 star. Loved Ishii throughout this tournament has really been kind of teasing, using other people's moves a lot. So I loved the kind of tease for the One Wing Angel here. Loved the big knees, the V-triggers repeatedly from Omega over and over again, trying to put Ishii down. Yeah, it's just, it's so funny to think, because before they had their first match, which I think was in, it was either the New Japan Cup or the one that they had in America, Omega had talked about in a, I think it was an interview with Dave Meltzer, about how, you know, they never got to wrestle and he really wanted to wrestle him. And then it just kind of comes through with the way that they work, that Omega does have a affinity for Ishii and his style, and it gets him in a way and respects him in a way that really helps to make the matches, because he puts, again, he puts more into it than I think other people do with Ishii, which it's kind of why Ishii, you know, is like, can be the champion in a European promotion, but he can't be the top champion in New Japan. It's because I think that people outside of Japan actually adore and respect Ishii a little bit more than the people inside. And Omega being, you know, not Japanese, even if he is, you know, have been there so long, it, I think it adds to like kind of that level of respect. The busted open mouth from Omega is fucking amazing. The blood pouring out of his mouth as he as the finish also adds a lot to the match for me. Just really, you know, he's beaten, he's bruised. He actually gets pinned by Ishii after kind of going undefeated for so long in the tournament. And then on top of that, he's just pouring blood out of his mouth. It's just really great symbolism to finish it, as Ishii then kind of stoically walks to the back with his arm pinned to his chest from the war that he had just went through.
Yeah, and I give it 4.5, too. And what I really loved early were Omega's just kind of fucking around, really toying around, like, you know, rubbing Ishii's head. So I kind of liked how this went, you know, where it built from there. And I thought there was a little shitty timing early on. But after that, they really... And the goofing around worked for me. You know, I don't want to... But they did have, like, something that the timing was off that looked really bad. But Ishii shows Omega how to play after Omega was playing with Ishii. Ishii is like, okay, now I'm really going to show you, and lights him up. Big moves, hot crowd. I thought this was fucking brilliantly built. I mean, just brilliant. And yeah, I mean, it just built and was layered and layered and layered and layered and layered. And yeah, this is how you build a classic match. And they did it in spades. That leads us into Ibushi versus Naito. And they had to follow that. And we have Naito after the leg. And I'm liking the focus on the leg. He's staying on Ibushi, not letting him get up. And I totally understand it because Ibushi has a history of shit-canning legwork. Now Naito's after the neck. Didn't like Ibushi landing on his feet on the reverse Rana. There we go. He's already, you know, kind of blowing it off. The Bombier shouldn't be happening after he's had his leg worked over. I still liked it. I get 3 3/4. On paper, it seemed better. Or from the crowd perspective. But man, Ibushi was running through and shit-canning a lot of fucking work that was done. And it bothered me. But they still had an incredible match. But it could have been so much better if they would have just, you know, played up the selling and stuff instead of just shit-canning it. What were your thoughts?
It's another example where I talk about I don't understand why it's the main event of the show, realistically, over the, you know, the champion in a big match with Ishii. I kind of get it with it being Naito and Ibushi, and it's a match where, you know, they have some history. They were tag team partners at a point for a little bit. They're both obviously super over, but, you know, you're right, there's the issues with the match. And I think that this match, more than any match that I've seen from Kota, really felt like almost kind of the older Kota Ibushi from DDT and stuff, where he's just kind of rushing through a lot of spots. rushing through the match as a whole, honestly, which you don't get. Nowhere near as bad as he was in the past, but
I just like how you just mentioned the DDT part. Those balcony moonsaults are straight DDT spots, aren't they?
Yeah, no, that's what he made his name is doing stuff like that in DDT.
Yeah, so he was in that zany mood, and I think it hurt him here. I think it bit him on the ass here, but go on.
Which, that's something that I could probably check, because I don't know what building this is in and where they're at, but it could be something where he knew that this was going to be predominantly the same kind of crowd that had seen him in DDT, and he was a little bit in that mode. Felt like Naito was turning it up a little bit in the same way, but at the same time, sometimes working harder, working faster, doing more is not necessarily going to give you more delivery on the match, I'll say. Some selling that was good, but like you talked about, then it's nothing, and then it's like, then by the end of the match when he's walking to the back, he's really putting over the stumbling selling to the back, and it's just, where was that in the match, you know? Where was that? How is it so much worse now that it's over? And I guess you could say adrenaline dump, whatever. I don't know. I gave it 3.5 stars. I expected more out of them, with the history and with, you know, this label that I feel like Naito is kind of in some ways turning into the same level of like histrionics from the company as like a Shawn Michaels, where like Shawn Michaels is the greatest wrestler in the history of wrestling because that's what they told you on WWE TV directly, and Naito with the Stardust genius, and now people taking that to mean, people are literally trying to translate that to mean that like what they're saying is that he's a genius at putting wrestling matches together, and it's just, I don't see it, honestly. He has some good matches, he can have good psychology, but he's not the biggest genius in the history of putting wrestling matches together, especially when on these same shows you're having Tanahashi have amazing matches that are put together by one of the... I mean, I think it's hard to not argue that Tanahashi is one of the greatest of all time. Like, the guy is just phenomenal still to this day. And then people are talking about it as if it's Naito who's this, you know, wrestling genius. And it's just... it drives me kind of crazy. So yeah, that's kind of my takeaway here, is it felt like they both kind of got sucked into maybe doing a little bit more, a little bit zanier, a little bit crazier than they normally do. And maybe part of that is, too, because they were in the main event and they're trying to show up a match that was just so fucking good before it with Ishii and Omega. But it's like, what did Ishii and Omega do that got over? They weren't doing flip dives out of the balconies and stuff, you know? They were hard hitting and selling their asses off, and that's what got over.
I can buy that, and it makes sense. But I do think Naito has good psychology, and I actually blame Ibushi here more than Naito, because he's the one who started shit-canning the work first.
Like I said, Naito can have it, but I don't think that he's wrestling genius of all time. I don't think he can have good psychological matches, but at the same time, he takes nights off, and he can be super lazy at times.
Alrighty. And that leads us into Suzuki, goes us to night 15. And we got Fale versus Yoshihashi. What do you think of this one?
I want to just give it one star and move on and say nothing, but it wasn't actually even that bad. It's just the finish and everything else kind of hurt it as well. Yoshihashi did a good job trying to chop down the giant tree and fight him off. And I thought that some of the stuff that they did actually was good and actually got Yoshihashi over. But then at the end, it's like, by the time it's over, I don't think anyone's going to remember any of the work or what happened or if anything mattered. So I'll give it 1.5 star and say that realistically my problem with it is that it felt like completely inconsequential, just another bullshit nothing. It reminds, you know, it makes me think of, I heard someone making the talking point, and I can't remember who, that like the point of it is that the only people who are watching every G1 match and all this are the hardcores like us, and what they're really playing for is getting over the angles for the crowd that's live there, so that maybe by the end of the tournament they'll kind of have an idea of what the storylines were supposed to be coming out of this, of who's doing what and who's into what. But it just, yeah, it just feels like more of the same. Doesn't mean anything. It's just over, and it didn't matter what Yoshihashi did, it wasn't going to, you know, have any bearings on the future for him or for Fale.
Yeah, I'm with you. I give it 2 stars. I like Fale destroying Yoshihashi's arm. Nice low-level dropkick by Yoshihashi. But, man, that finish was flat as fuck. That's like Flip Gordon thinking the earth is flat. Totally flat. Then we got Minoru Suzuki versus Hangman Page. I thought they had a banger here. Love Page taking it to Suzuki early on. And this is where he's back in the fucking babyface mold, you know? He's hard hitting. Love Suzuki's response to being called an asshole. Big match that elevated Paige here. Total elevation here. 3.5 stars. And I think this is the type of match that you can say this match made so and so. This match, this match made Hangman Page in Japan. I feel. What did you think of it?
Yeah, 3.75 from me. Loved the moonsault off the stage to Suzuki. Really felt like a real standout spot and a standout moment for Paige in the tournament to be remembered. It's going against the big bad and really taking it to him and brawling, taking Suzuki, who's the brawl in the crowd guy, and brawling him in the crowd and even going and hitting that big moonsault. We talked about it with Ibushi with the big moonsaults off the balconies and all that, but here it felt like it mattered. It really did. It felt like a big fucking deal. It's something to hang your hat on and remember. It would have been nice if it was more towards the end of the match instead of opening the match, but what are you going to do? That's kind of how these matches are set up now. The brawl in the match, I thought the fight was great. Suzuki really being that dismissive dick, throwing big strikes and calling for Paige to get up and come bring it to him more. And Paige keeps fighting everything off and selling the arm the whole way through, even as he continues towards the end to just say fuck it and takes off the elbow pad and is continuing to look for big strikes, even with the arm that's clearly injured. Great action. You talked about it. Something that you could say, you know, makes Paige coming out of it. I think Paige picking up the win is a huge fucking deal coming out of it. Feels like something important moving forward. I gave it 3.75 star. Good, really good stuff.
Then we got White versus Makabe. Fuck, was this boring. I didn't care about this one iota. It was boring. Their work meant nothing to me. Gave it 2 stars. It was just so ho-hum. Poor wrestling. I feel bad for him. What were your thoughts here?
1.75. Felt like they were trying to tell a story with White being able to figure out a trick to steal the win in the end. But realistically, I mean, it's Makabe. It's like I could get into it with the story that they're telling if it was almost anybody else. Like if he had done, kind of tried to do the same story with like even Big Mike, who's in the next match, I think I could buy into it more than with Makabe. It's just, I just don't care about Makabe's matches. I don't buy into him as an ass kicker. So having a guy like White, who's been presented pretty strongly throughout the tournament, even if it is strongly as like kind of a conniving, cheating heel, it still doesn't make any sense to me that he would be having so much trouble with Makabe just completely no-selling so much of his offense as well, kind of really hurting the match for me.
And then we got Elgin versus Tanahashi. Man, this is boring too, in my opinion. It was all about the big story was finally Elgin uses his strength, and that was a big difference maker. And then, you know, then they went back to normal. But my God, this is pretty rough. Are you 2.5 stars? What were your thoughts?
I think I liked it I liked it more than you. I liked the history being played off of with them being former tag team partners. I liked, that maybe Elgin was taking it a little bit easier than he could have, and then when he finally did turn it up with the attacks, that's when he was able to kind of get the better. But Tanahashi comes back, gets a big win. I mean, this is what felt more like a send fans home happy kind of match, which would have also then made it make sense in like maybe as just a quicker main event match as opposed to what it was, which is a little bit drawn out and obviously underneath the main event. But yeah, I mean, I'm with you. There was long stretches of time where it felt like it was just nothing and no reason to get invested, which is interesting from Tanahashi because so many times I talk about how Tanahashi, that's like his key selling point is that it's easy to get invested in every one of his matches. So I don't know what the issue was there between the two. Like I said, the history with them as a tag team, I think, could have been used a little bit better. But maybe that's what hurt the match in some ways is that they were holding some stuff back because they're playing off that history, that there was a respect level there. And I don't know, maybe it's something that should have been saved for like a first-time matchup between the two, saved for a situation where there's a little bit more intensity behind it.
Then we got Okada and Evil, and I enjoyed this. You're up. I'm sorry. What do you think of it?
I was going to say, you've started, I think, like 3 in a row. I don't mind if you want to continue, but...
Did I? Jeez, my bad.
It's all good. I liked this, but it felt a little bit Okada paint by numbers, and I think that he could put more effort into trying to help make Evil look good. And I think Evil did a good job himself getting himself over. I like some of the stuff he's doing with the eye gouges, you know, the diving off the apron for like almost a cutter into the ring guardrail, stuff like that. But it felt like Okada was really trying to just do his, you know, his basic shtick that he does so often. The stuff on the rampway was interesting. I kind of liked the DDT on the ramp as the counter there, and then continuing on with the diving dropkick that looked a little awkward and clunky, which was kind of nice because of how many times he's got such a beautiful dropkick. It's the best dropkick in the history of wrestling, and I like him using it more as a weapon here, just diving and throwing his legs at him. That said, yeah, I think that part of it too is I talk about Evil being so good as one or the other, but I felt like here he didn't really commit to heel or babyface enough. He wasn't necessarily as brutal and violent as he could be. You know, and then you have the big finish that it felt like Okada didn't do anything to make me feel like Evil earned kind of the big teasy finish that he does in every match, and it just feels even more tacked on when you're in that setting and you didn't feel like you built to it in any way.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I gave it 2.25 star, honestly.
I did a little bit more than you. I gave it 3.5, but I'm with you on a lot of that. I thought it was just a good, solid match. Snug at times. But yeah, it was just nice, solid work is all you could say, you know. But it never really drew you in and stuff. And then we go into night 16, and we open up with Ishii versus Juice Robinson. I really love Juice's sell of those throat chops, especially the one where he spit out. Big slugfest, really stiff finish. Just good, solid stuff, 3.25. What were your thoughts?
This was a great match selling the... Both of these guys obviously are very good at selling, but both of them at this point in the tournament really selling the gruelingness of having this long tournament with big matches repeatedly over and over again, where even before they were really laying into each other, they were already selling the cumulative effects of damages of having so many big matches in a row. So I love that, because these guys opening up this night and doing that really helps set the tone, I think, for the entire block, for everyone. Really, not the block, but the tournament, for every person involved, as being like, this has been long and grueling. These guys, honestly, the rest of the wrestlers in the tournament should, like, give these guys some credit for helping get over the tournament as a whole being just fucking brutal and violent by coming out and doing this kind of match. So it makes it easier for you on the rest of the card to really be able to sell and have the crowd invested, because it feels like it's been just a war that everyone's been through. So yeah, there's good stuff there. The back and forth, the selling, everything's great. 3.25 star, good action from both guys. And really, I mean, opening up and, like I said, setting the tone for everyone else and really making it easier to have the crowd invested in the rest of the tournament. So got to give them big props for that, because it's not just them, it's for everyone.
What do you think of Zack Sabre Jr. and Goto?
Really liked this. Zack did a good job here again, kind of playing up that he'll get himself a little bit hot-headed and willing to brawl, but didn't do it too much and really focused on taking Goto apart, grappling him as much as he could, did not try to stand and bang with him, which can be his downfall a lot of times. Always looking for the big arm work, really, you know, wrapping up Goto all around, taking him to the mat. Goto does a great job of selling the, not just selling the pain of the moves, but selling the frantic nature with which he wants to break up every submission hold, constantly trying to get to the ropes, constantly trying to figure out a way to put Zack down even for a minute to get some kind of reprieve from the attacks. Repeatedly kind of like showing almost like he's lost, not lost, but like that he's just, yeah, like lost on the idea of what to do next. Just can't think of how to get out of this. Zack really kind of swamps him in a lot of ways, always able to grab a hold, always able to counter everything. Really good way to get over a guy like Zack, who's, you know, noticeably much smaller than Goto. Goto, you know, he gets the win, and then Zack, even with the dickhead teasing him, grabbing his belt afterwards and getting in his face, talking about he's going to take that NEVER title, which is a great little thing, because I talk about Zack and what he is, and I think that Zack going for that NEVER title, which has been treated like as if it's like it's the strong style title, it's the title for the guys who like to bang, him being this kind of asshole that, like I said, he fancies himself able to keep up with the bigger guys in brawling and fighting, but he really can't. That's just his own hot temper getting in his way. The idea that he would then turn around and try to take that title would be even more disrespectful to like kind of the lineage of that title and what it means as the strong, hard, you know, hard hitting, hard fighting title. So I love that little piece as well. Good stuff. All in all, 3-star match. Great. Both guys really good. Good drama. But yeah, I thought really it was a nice showcase for Zach more than anything else.
What'd you give it?
3 stars.
Yeah, that's what I did. I thought it was good, solid work. The big moment I thought was Goto getting his foot on the rope when in the submission. They just worked. I mean, it just wasn't like a classic or anything, but just good, solid wrestling. Tama Tonga versus Kota Ibushi. I mean, this thing sucked. 2 stars. I mean, Ibushi's just selling Tama's shitty fucking offense. I mean, come on. Terrible. I mean, we don't need him in the tournament. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. On top of everything else that you're saying, you know, there's the crowd bullshit in the middle that just has to be there that feels so tacked on and pointless. Kota sold more in this match than I think he sold in any fucking match in the tournament up until this point, which, like I said, I mean, they set the precedent in the first match that everyone is really beat up, but I don't need to see it in the Tama match that that's the match that Kota's going to sell his ass off, you know what I mean? It's just, goddamn. You could almost say it's smart. Tama didn't do any legwork. He doesn't really have any legwork, but it does help keep Ibushi from being able to shit can any selling, as you like to say. So there's that, but then there's just rampant bullshit with the fucking interference and the ref and the mixer. And I mean, it doesn't matter what they do, like I said, because this shit happens in all the other matches. So why is it that now in this setting, you know, the ref is doing DQs and carrying? I mean, obviously this ends up getting a finish, but it just continuously, it's like, oh, okay, so there's a bunch of fucking wildness going on the outside. Omega is fighting off the other Bullet Club people, and the ref just doesn't care, isn't, like, getting involved in that, saying, like, ah, fuck it, let's throw this out. But then in other settings, when there's a bunch of hoopla and all this craziness going on, the refs are throwing the matches out and just giving a DQ to the, you know, to the Tama Tonga or Fale or whoever. So it's just more of the same bullshit. Then, you know, play into the angle. Now Omega's injured because he got oh, I'm sorry, I didn't give my rating on this. I gave it 1.5 stars. But then the angle is playing into the Omega is injured afterwards and setting up into the next match, which...
Bought into it all. No one in them... I know New Japan can do these flash finishes, but not in the G1. They're not going to discredit Kenny Omega this bad, poorly, going into the final because they're going to protect him, I guess, in Bushi. So, God. But this finally, Omega and Yano, I mean, the crowd was, they laughed, they got a kick out of it, but then it escalates into where it had almost everybody in the ring that the crowd hates in it. I give it a 1.5 stars. It was kind of like, you know, Kenny having a popcorn, you know, he's wrestling the blow-up doll. I mean, he was having fun. Doesn't scream top guy to me. What were you thinking?
I gave this a dud. I was pissed off. They set up this heated angle that he got attacked, and he's so injured that, oh my God, he's going to lose to Yano because of how injured he is, right? You're doing all this drama. You're trying to set up this fucking storyline about the guy who's undefeated, you know, or, you know, the champion in the tournament who's gone so long, done so well, and now he's going up against the comedy guy and he's injured. And Kenny sells it for, you know, maybe a minute, you know, a couple near falls. And then he goes into comedy spots.
Yeah.
Where's the drama? Where's the fucking injury angle? Where is all of this? You just complete. And it smacks of protection. It smacks of... Yep. Well, we know that you like to goof around with Toru Yano, but, you know, you're the champion now, so we have to protect you going into it, so you can't just go out there and have your goofy Toru Yano match, so we got to set up this angle that you're injured first. You know, and so it's just, it feels like protecting him against Toru Yano because he had to have been injured first, but then how quickly do you drop all of that, any pretense of the injury angle, to just go into the comedy?
And it almost reeks of protecting yourself from yourself.
Yeah, exactly. It's all, it feels like a protection thing for Kenny that I think is bullshit. I hate when you see stuff that's just blatantly about protecting someone and kind of their overness or whatever in that regard, like, I don't mind protecting someone, like, having them just win matches clean, having them come out there and be strong. That kind of protection I'm fine with. Protect Roman Reigns, you know? The kind of protect where it's like, make him look good even though you're going to beat three guys and he's one of the guys that's going to get beat. That kind of CM Punk, which, you know, funny enough to bring up that podcast right now with everything that's going on with those two. But, you know, it's that idea where it's like, just have Kenny fucking beat the guy, you know, or have Kenny mess around and play with him a little bit like he always does. And then he's still going to win and it's fine, but don't do all this. And then when you completely drop it, it just ruins everything for me. I was so fucking pissed off coming out of this match. That's why I said, gave it a dud. I could not get into it. The fucking suplex on the foam pads as like a comedy spot. I mean, God damn it. Like, you sell that the foam pads hurt your back just a second later when you get hit with it, but when you get suplexed on it, you sell it like you just fell onto, you know, feathers and pillows and all this. It's just, I was so fucking pissed off coming out of this match. Kenny Omega really disappointed me doing all this, and it wasn't even in the ring. It's just the trying to be too smart for his own good stuff and you know, playing around and, like I said, completely forgetting that you're setting up this heated angle that you're getting attacked and you do this. I don't know, man. This was just fucking horseshit.
Now he leads us into Sonata vs. Naito. Was this the Sonata match that TJ Hawk went bananas over? They hated that pissed him off? That people were putting it over?
I don't know. Maybe. Maybe it was.
Okay.
It's all very right, likely. Yeah. Right. That's your review?
No, I was going to let you speak first.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm just joking around. It's like, my review is TJ Hawk hated this match. No, which tells you everything you need to know about the quality of the match. I actually liked this match. I thought that they sold the drama between the two really well. I thought that they did a good job of kind of putting over that they know each other super well. They have counters for counters. They both worked super hard. Naito really put out maximum effort because he's going against, you know, the guy that's probably nipping at his heels a lot in a lot of ways in the LIJ. He may be the top guy, but it's kind of that Flair Tully thing where you think about, you know, that he, you know, he might be just as good as him. He might even be better than him. He's just not the top guy. He's not
example,
the one.
Yeah,
he's not the leader of the group, but he's pretty damn good. You know, he could even possibly beat him. So it's like better to have him on his side. So I thought that they did a good job. Like I said, the trading was good. This is the stuff where, like, I'm fine with how many counters of counters everyone can do because these guys know each other so well and it makes sense. You know, it just sucks that New Japan kind of exploited this style of matchup because it's so hot and it works really well to get the crowd over, that they do this all the time to where it makes it to where it, like, loses its effectiveness in a setting where it makes perfect sense.
Here it is. We'll say it again. Diminishing returns.
Yeah, that's it. Loved the big launcher where Naito launches Sonata over his shoulders into the turnbuckle. Even if it was a little bit off, I thought that spot looked really cool and really nasty for him to be doing to his own partner there. After it's all said and done, after a really grueling battle, Naito gets the win. And I love that they come out, they bring out Hiromu's jacket just to kind of show, like, hey, we're still a team. We're still all together in this, our fallen brother. But this is still LIJ, and even though we had a, you know, this grueling ass match, you know, there's no heat in, you know, in LIJ. LIJ's still a family, whatever. Really loved that. Really thought that was a great little kind of capper off on the story of a really, really, really good match. I give it 3.75. And part of that is probably because I still had a nasty taste in my mouth from the match before it that really pissed me off. But I thought that they did a great job here.
All right, I give it 3.75 too. And I'm with you. I love the counters of the counters. I like Naito working the neck. I felt Sonata slugged off some of the leg work early on, and especially with his comebacks, but that was what really bothered me. But I thought the drama played well, and that's what to me was the key factor in the match. And then finally, we're on our final night, night 17. We open up with Elgin versus Makabe, and again, I mean, both guys feel like they're petering out at this point. And here we get a 2.5-star match. Kevin Kelly on commentary puts over Michael Elgin as a videotape nerd. That'll get him over to the regular audience. I mean, fuck. Why are you telling people this?
And you know what? It's gonna it's going to super help too. You're right, because you know the casual fans who aren't major wrestling nerds watching all the videotapes are not going to relate to it, and they're going to be like, what the fuck, why is this guy doing this? And then the hardcore fans who do all that, obviously it's going to change their opinion of Elgin being, you know, a rape apologist. They're going to go, oh yeah, but he also likes All Japan, so it's fine. It's like, yeah, what the fuck do you think you're doing here?
Yeah, this is just terrible. I think it's just one of them factoids that doesn't help enhance him at all. And then Rocky, they were talking about moves for Elgin. Like, who else can do this? And I love Rocky throwing in, maybe Jeff Cobb.
Yeah, I thought that was so good. There's like, oh, Michael Elgin is clearly the strongest guy in New Japan. No one tells him Rocky's like, well, maybe Jeff Cobb. And it's like, it's so funny because it's like, Jeff is not even like a full-time New Japan guy really at this point. It just really felt like a dig just to put it in there. And but it did make me question, because I was like, God damn, like I would never, it feels like an old trope of wrestling to have a commentator say something like that about, like, you know, Michael Elgin's the strongest guy in New Japan. And I was thinking about it, and I was like, I don't think you'd ever hear something like that in WWE nowadays. Like, they don't really talk about attributes that way, where they would be like, he's the strongest guy in the WWE, you know? So I kind of liked it in that regard.
Yeah, I did, but I was laughing at Rocky's.
Yeah, Rocky's spot was great.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was a decent Power Man match. 2.5 stars. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, it was good up until the rope hung Spider German thing, and Elgin flips off, and then he throws those two super kicks that looked like such dog shit. They're low super kicks to the head of Makabe hanging in the corner, and they looked so fucking bad. Elgin has a lot of really good strikes, you know, from the forearms up top because he's so big, but maybe knock off the super kick, especially as he's wearing the seemingly Lance Storm inspired gear, and he's throwing just the worst looking drop or super kick, you know, after I think Lance Storm had one of the better looking super kicks. So yeah, that even did not help the situation. You know, good tough guy match. I think the right setting helps Makabe to me in a lot of ways look a little bit better. That said, 2.75 star for me. Not something I'm gonna have on my rewatch list at the end of the year.
Yeah, and it helps because he doesn't have to do anything really athletic per se. You know, he can stand there.
Yeah.
What do you think of Hangman Page and Yoshihashi?
Hangman Page is working his ass off. I mean, Yoshihashi's not taking nights off either, really. But there's just something about him missing there. That said, I thought good action. Not quite the level
of... Could it be that he doesn't even look like a wrestler?
That's probably a big part of it. He's dopey. He's dopey.
Yeah.
He doesn't come across like an athlete. He doesn't have the lovable loser thing. He comes across... Like Mikey Whipwreck, right? Lovable loser kind of thing.
Yeah.
Comes out in t-shirts with, you know, shorts and knee pads that look like they don't fit. And he just looks like maybe he's kind of a guy out of the crowd who got thrown in there and just destroyed. And you buy into it. But Yoshihashi comes across like the same guy, but they put actual gear on him and they just act like he's a normal wrestler. So it doesn't work, you know? And that's, so I think that's a really good point to make. I thought that Paige tried really hard. A lot of people at this point are feeling like they're just phoning it in.
You
know, when you're mathematically eliminated. And I don't know if it's a directive from the back, because it feels like it's so across the board that once you're mathematically eliminated from the tournament, they really just don't seem to put as much effort into the matches at all. Coming out of this, I give it 2.5 stars, you know? I'm with you, just nothing.
Yep, I'm with you, 2.5. Good, solid back-and-forth matches, but nothing. And then we have Suzuki versus Folly. I mean, it was just a solid fight, another 2.75 fight. Guys slugging each other, but didn't really, didn't do much for me. What about you?
Yeah, and I liked Suzuki, you know, fighting him around the ring and getting the advantage. I liked the idea of it. And, you know, you could have built this up and had it feel important because, you know, it's two of the guys who throughout the tournament are just pulling a lot of bullshit repeatedly.
Yeah.
But, again, it's just the stakes don't seem like they're there. I gave it 2.75 as well. The you know, just blatant DQ finish, whatever, doesn't, you know, coming out of it just does not matter. And you could have made it matter, even though it's like I said, even though they're mathematically eliminated, you could have made it feel like it was important coming out of it either way, you know, because these guys want to both show that they're the kings of bullshit style, but instead it's just nothing.
And we have that same problem with this match where both guys, you can take your point you made here, but use a different way where both these guys are former Young Lions who want to be known as the number one, you know, young guy in the company. And the match was just there. What do you think of it?
Oh, Evil and Jay White?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. It felt like exactly what you would expect from them on paper with the moves and everything that they're doing, but it was a step off and there was passion missing.
Yeah, and I'm so fed up seeing White work the back on the guardrails. It's just, you know.
Over and
eight
over.
Eight matches
and
in
over.
Or whatever. Yeah. I think it's, what is it, eight matches, I think, at this point, nine?
Yeah, this is nine matches.
Cena done it.
And I mean, but the thing that's interesting is coming through this, the matches felt like they're getting progressively better just because of the mechanics level of the guys who are in there being like able to execute everything, you know, really well. So it's like, right. I still gave this match like 2.75, but it's like, you know, it's just missing any drama.
I'm totally with you. And then I give it 2.75. Then what do you think of Tanahashi versus Okada?
Well, it's interesting because all the other matches felt like they were pretty quick and they were pretty nothing. And then this whole show was built around this big, you know, draw match where they go the distance. And that's probably why they were saving the time and saving the drama and saving everything. I thought the commentary did a great job on this match, talking about the history between the two, talking about, you know, the first match was the quickest. And I do think that they missed that as an analysis point, as something you can actually talk about, which is the first match was the quickest. Okada came out of the gates and kind of bum-rushed Tanahashi and got the win. And then ever since then, there is that kind of hanging doubt is, why do the matches keep getting longer? And why does Tanahashi keep getting, almost keeps getting the better of Okada? Is it because he figured him out? And the only reason why Okada was better than him in the beginning is because, you know, Tanahashi hadn't had the time to figure out the game plan to take him out, you know? And it feels like that's a story that should be being told. As throughout the match here, he's, you know, working over the leg and he's put it together. He's figured out how to take out Okada. Loved the leg work. The dragon screws into the ropes were great, then transitioned into like a torture version of the Texas Cloverleaf was a great spot. Loved Okada selling that as Tanahashi is just really picking him apart. Thought that Okada did a good job of continuing to sell it throughout the match. Even when he was hitting, you know, drop kicks and some high spots, he would go right back to selling the leg afterwards in a really good way. When Tanahashi hits the Styles Clash, I was like, oh yeah, he used to always do that move. That used to be like a Tanahashi regular move before AJ Styles came back. And it was funny because then I thought about it and I'm like, geez, like, really bad for Yoshitatsu, obviously, but you know, that injury that AJ Styles gave to Yoshitatsu on the Styles Clash was the difference maker that turned that move from being just, you know, a signature spot from Tanahashi to being like an exalted killer finisher for AJ Styles. And it's just, it sucks that it has to be done that way. But I mean, that's the history of wrestling, right? The, you know, Stan the Lariat Hansen became the Lariat and a big deal because he broke Bruno's neck with a body slam, but they pretended like it was the Lariat, you know? And it's just like, that's the history of wrestling, getting stuff out of that. So it's just funny seeing Tanahashi bust that out again. It's like, oh, I guess AJ's been gone long enough that he can just do the Styles Clash again. And maybe this is just like dipping his toe in the water, teasing it. But yeah, love the back and forth. Love the teasing of the looking for the Rainmaker, even towards the finish, even with the last few seconds going, he's looking for the Rainmaker. And Tanahashi then goes up for a high fly flow over and over, gets the kick out, goes up for it again, and then, but it's too late. There's not enough time. Really great storyline, I think. And people were talking about the kind of draw finish between Okada and Omega. And how it should have been Okada, or it should have been Omega looking for the win instead of Okada, because, you know, Omega should have been the one looking like he's getting closer to winning or whatever. And the storyline is hurt by that. And it's like, actually, I kind of like it. And they're doing the same thing here, I think, is that Tanahashi, I think they told the story. Tanahashi would have won the match if he had waited out the clock, but he wanted to get the win. He wanted to prove going into it that he would win. And I liked even Kevin Kelly there again. Like, this match I thought was Kevin Kelly's best kind of adding stuff and best kind of talking. When he talked about it, he said Tanahashi likes having kind of a chip on his shoulder, and so even though he didn't win here and he really wanted to win, he might be able to manufacture a little bit of a chip on his shoulder himself about the fact that it was a time limit draw that sent him into the finals, and talk about people are saying the only reason why I'm in the finals is because of time limit and I didn't earn it or deserve it. So I kind of like that was a nice little touch to kind of give you, you know, the psyche of Tanahashi moving forward into the finals. Great, like I said, great action, great storytelling. These guys are just really fantastic together. That said, I gave it 4.25 star. I think this ends up, you know, this could possibly be in the match of the year contender conversation. We'll see by the end of the year. But, I mean, yeah, these guys, I don't know. I felt like, I think a lot of people think that they've done everything they can together, but I think that there's still something there. I think that these guys take a little bit of time off and they're able to come back and have some hot matches together.
Yeah, I give four. It had a big time feel to it. They're teasing the draw early on where it felt like they're working towards it, but they did a good enough job to hide it. I liked seeing Tanahashi. He was doing basic work. It wasn't really engaging early on, but I don't mind that as long as it pays off. I didn't particularly like the shotgun knees. I wish Okada could have done something differently, even though he sold them. I just wish he would have done something a little different. It just took down the match like a little for me. And sometimes the Tanahashi's legwork looked a little soft, where it didn't look like it could break an egg, some of his kicks to Okada's knee. But at other times it looked fine, but at moments it looked pretty weak at times. But overall, really good stuff, and they really had the crowd the whole entire way, and they were going nuts, which I think really helped raise the match in and of itself, and made me enjoy it. Okay, man, on that note, why don't we take a breather? Let's real quick. One thing about the G1, I will say, is it really exposes the New Japan wrestling style in the sense we're seeing, okay, at least every 2 out of every 5 matches, we're seeing the count out of 19, right? Like they're teasing the
count. Oh, yeah, yeah. Sorry, I was on mute. Yeah, I mean, okay. We're constantly seeing the teasing of the long count outs.
We've seen them abuse and ignore the refs. Like, you know, they mean nothing in this promotion, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
See a lot of back and forth striking. Some of it means something, but then sometimes it's just, this is what we're going to fucking do, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, there's tropes that feel like they're just forced and it's just what you do constantly and that's it, repeatedly.
And to me, the final thing is, you're working the super physical style and it almost loses its physicality in it like this, because like the head dropping becomes immune to you. Normally you'd be like, whoa, but now by the end of it, you're like, okay, great, another head drop, you know, where it meant nothing towards the end of the tournament.
Yeah, I mean, these guys have to go out there and basically break their necks to get people interested even slightly in their matches.
Yeah, I mean, because we got Sami and Sami. And I, if you're like, you know, you're totally gung-ho to the style, I totally get it. I'm always about storytelling, and a lot of the stuff they're doing is just like a spot or a moment we're doing. It really... You know, a near fall at 19, does that even add anything to a match, really, for the most part?
At this point, no.
No. So, I don't know. Anything else you want to add before we take a break?
No, I mean, it's just a lot of the same stuff repeatedly. I feel like a couple years ago, God, it feels like it's only a couple years ago, but when you really think about it, it's like, I think they were saying this is Sonata's third G1 or something in a row, which I thought was crazy. I think it was Sonata, but it was someone where I was like, that feels insane that he's been in that many times already, because it felt like he was just recently pretty new. But it's like, God, just a few years ago, it was like every match on every G1 felt like it was a much watched thing. Everyone was going 110% every match. This was not that long ago. And even still then, I think that the star ratings were inflated, but it feels like the matches aren't as good and the star ratings are even more inflated. And it's just fucking wild to me that it's turning into that. I think we're getting to the point where next year, I mean, you know, for the show, I like that we continue to do it, but I'm getting to the point where next year I'm like questioning, like, should we continue to really review every single G1 match?
It's because it's the chore to sit through and watch all this stuff in a timely manner, you know?
And is it necessary? Are people really clamoring to fucking hear about it at this point? Because it feels like it's so much the same stuff over and over again. I don't know. You know what I mean? That's just kind of where I'm feeling now. I feel like there was a time not too long ago where, yeah, you should watch everything on the G1 because you got the chance of something that you wouldn't expect, really knocking it out of the park and being amazing, and then everything is going to be at least good and stand out in some way. And now we're getting to the point where
everything. There's a few really good matches, and the undercard stuff really rarely stands out. You get random stuff, like we talked about the Hangman Page Jay White match or Hangman Page Suzuki match that were really good, but there's not a lot of stuff that's standing out that's just like a random mid-card match that's really, really good, you know?
Yeah, I'm with you. Totally with you. All right, man. Let's take a break, and we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place for Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new. You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceForNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceForNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceForNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And we're back. You know, folks, we took a hiatus last week because I was at Scenic City because of the G1. We're not going to cover both NXTs and both MLWs. We're just going to cover the most current of those two episodes. So let's look at MLW Fusion episode 16. And this one opens up with a Sami Callihan promo. I like his motivation here. What about you?
Yeah, I think we're all constantly clamoring for more Sami Callihan promos as much as possible everywhere. He's not getting enough mic time in AAW or TNA. No, it was good. And honestly, it's interesting watching MLW compared to Evolve. I actually watched the most recent Evolve shows, which I've been keeping up on Evolve pretty well, but just not... We haven't really been reviewing it or talking about it as much. And it's fun because they use so many of the same guys, but some guys they don't, you know, both use, and Sami Callihan, one of them. And so he stands out here in MLW, but it has been interesting seeing the kind of comparison between the way the two companies use all the different people.
And you brought it up. I mean, one of the main reasons why we don't is, I mean, I think Evolve's price point is crazy.
Yeah.
Why would I only get that promotion? What is it right now? You get...
I don't even know. I thought you sign up for Club WWN, and I thought that at one point you get a discount off of the shows that are already like $15 to get the VOD and the live stream. You get like a 10% discount or something. But then I'm hearing now the stuff shows up on Club WWN pretty quickly to where you don't need to do that unless you really got to watch it live. And the Club WWN subscription is like $10. But yeah, you're only getting...
one promotion.
You're only getting that one show from that one promotion.
Well, as opposed to you getting high spots and powerbomb. So it's like, you know, it comes down to, you know, brass tacks. Like I drop my progress because it's just, you know, and stuff. So it's just, you know,
yeah.
I have the network and I have high spots and powerbomb. I think that's enough. And I still have Rev Pro and I have New Japan. So, I mean... that's still plenty of subscriptions I'm paying for. So to me, you know, sometimes you got to make your choices. And Evolve, since it's that's a company that really doesn't run that many angles, and it's become it's kind of almost like become a almost. And now their big thing was they had the biggest stars on indies Now none of them. They're all in.
I mean, they have some of the biggest stars. They do have the biggest stars in indie wrestling as their champions, really. But, you know, Shane Strickland, Joey Janela. But they're not just Evolve stars. Like, when you're talking about, like, making that they stand out in Evolve, they don't. I mean, those guys are the biggest stars, but they're everywhere.
Yeah, and they're just starting in Evolve, too.
Right, and they both kind of, I mean, they double, both guys won the titles kind of almost out of nowhere. So it feels like, yeah both
because,
of them are kind of like.
Because their other guys were leaving, yeah.
Right, and it felt like they're kind of trying to play catch up to all the other places who have actually been booking those guys for a while. So yeah, I mean, they definitely don't have the same buzz or kind of over-the-top feel of being like the top indie promotion. So it's not worth that prestige dollar amount to try to watch those shows.
Yep. All right, and then we go to Brody King versus Jimmy Havoc. You know, I know Havoc went over, but you know what? I think Brody King has way more upside than Jimmy Havoc. And if you're a promotion that's trying to run, you know, trying to break out like MLW, you think you need these are the guys you got to take chances on and be right on. And I think Brody King's one of them. I think they just used him in the wrong role. The guy could be a big time badass heel or babyface, wherever you want to put him. And they had a solid match here, but Brody King needs to be pushed harder because he's something new, and he doesn't, he's not exposed like Jimmy Havoc, who, I mean, we'll say what he is, but I mean, Havoc's not a great worker. I mean, he's a good promo, he's a good guy to have on your roster, but I don't. And at times he can be pushed to the top, but I think Brody King has a lot more potential. What are your thoughts on that statement and the match itself?
I agree with everything, honestly. The match was good, actually. I thought the match helped to present Havoc almost the closest that anyone's done to presenting him again at like kind of the level that he was in Progress at a time. But at the same time, I think Brody King is the guy that you should be pushing. He delivers better in the ring. I think his promo and his aura can work just as well. Havoc can get over as a promo guy, but I mean, Havoc, I feel like this is the closest anyone's come to getting Havoc right again after Progress, but even still, I don't know if the investment is worth it. And it just shows there's like a level of kind of behind the times that the MLW, you know, booking committee is on, where they're like excited to try to get over Jimmy Havoc in America because they were such big marks for Progress that they want to have like do the same thing, and they're not realizing that time's passed.
Yeah, and then you have a blue chipper. I mean, that's the key. I mean, you bring in some of these younger talent, and I mean, what's the big black guy's name? What's his name?
Barrington Hughes.
He's no Brody King, you know.
No. And, but Brody should be getting that push.
Yeah, and Hughes is getting pushed bigger. I mean. I get it. I mean, well, maybe hopefully they'll show me wrong, prove me wrong. Then we get a Brian Pillman Jr. angle with Kelvin Sullivan playing off the 1995. I respect you, Booker man. That sounds so Vince Russo right there. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, great stuff there with playing off of that. That angle from, what was it, like the 80s at this point? I mean, Jesus.
It's 1995, actually.
Okay. But still, I mean, Jesus, that is so, so old to be talking about at this point. But, you know.
It's before Nitro. Or it was during Nitro, it was during Nitro's first year. You know, I mean, that's how, I mean, it's nuts. And by seeming Vince Russo, that's an insult.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, then we get this segment that looks like Loki paid Callahan, so now Callahan is technically the bounty hunter, and I know they didn't do it, but it almost like they heard our critique about how can Loki be the bounty hunter and now the champion. It works if there's you pay the bounty hunter to hurt somebody. Now it feels like they, and I know they have not, they didn't recon it. But now they finally realize this is how the angle is supposed to be, and they're trying to flesh it out and fit it out the best way possible. I found it funny. What about you?
Yeah, it's like they're trying to kind of, like you said, retcon and kind of like
fix the angle midstream, being like, oh yeah, Callahan and his crew are the bounty hunters, and Loki's the focus champion guy. Which, I mean, you know, whatever. That's, I mean, if that's what they want to do, that's fine by me. I think it makes the angle make more sense, but it feels like trying to fix it midstream.
Yeah, you're square peg circle.
Yeah,
you know
exactly.
Filthy Tom highlights of last week, blah blah blah. Filthy Tom promo. You know, I he's at a Boston Red Sox game. Good for him. What do you think of it?
Yeah, good stuff. I mean, Tom is the guy, and it's another one where it feels like they're trying to fix something. And I don't necessarily know that having Strickland be the first champion and being the focus guy was necessarily something that was like a bad thing that really needed to be fixed. But it does feel like they're clearly trying to go now to focusing as Tom as their guy, which is not necessarily a bad idea. Who knows what's going on with Strickland, obviously, with the WWN stuff. I don't know if that means that he's not long for MLW or what. It seems like they share talent, but it also seems like sometimes they don't.
Because they had Riddle, then got no more Riddle.
He got pulled, yeah.
Yeah.
Which I don't know about that. Did Riddle get pulled because of WWE from MLW, or did he get pulled because of WWN from MLW?
At the time, everyone thought it was WWN. You know, why would WWE pull him? I mean, I know WWE could pull him if was he under contract with him at the time, and I thought, either way, who cares?
Exactly.
That's a good point. It's something to think about. What do you think of Jake Hager and Simon Gotch?
Good job. I thought that they did a good job presenting kind of what we talked about before, where the Gotch should be the setup guy for continuing the feud with Tom and Hager. And I thought that they did a good job of having Gotch look okay, but not on his level. But then the finish, I didn't really like the finish with the spit in the face and just the big boot to put him down. I thought that that was anticlimactic for the finish, but whatever, it was still good.
And I don't know about using Rob Parker here, I get it. He used to say Sid ruled the world, and now he's using it for Hager's catchphrase. I don't know. I again, it's a little too, you know,
little 1980s, too dated.
1990s. Yeah. This was 1990. I think it was 93 when Sid appeared on Slambury, and Parker cut the. I have the guy who rules the world, and it was Sid. I'm pretty sure it was 93 Slambury. So now we revisited 93, 95 on this show.
Perfect.
Keep track. Then we got an Aria Blake interview that's interrupted by MGF, and one word, a couple words, weird fucking segment. What do you think of this thing?
Yeah, and they did it. I mean, I talked about it before that you could kind of try to play it off, but they flat out say Joey Janela's girlfriend, Aria Blake. And it's just like, everyone knows that he's with Penelope Ford. She's a big part of the act. Realistically, I was just having this conversation. I think her coming across like a bigger star is also what's helped Joey Janela come across like a bigger star. The two are linked, undoubtedly. Yep. In all of wrestling, everyone knows it. You, like I said, I'm fine if you were playing it off like she was a valet here in this company, but saying girlfriend is just not necessary. So, yeah, and then MJF shows. And it does feel very blatant that it's going to be a turn angle and she's going to go with MJF, and that makes sense. She's a good-looking girl. She can fill the role. She can do what she needs to. She's good, probably a good fit with MJF, but it's just a dumb way to have set it up.
Yep. And then they get over the top 10, put it over. I enjoy this segment. I've always been a big fan of this. It gives the talent stakes so you know where they stand. I think it does it. I think it's smart, honestly. And then he gives the matches stakes.
Yeah.
What do you think of it?
I'm with you. I like it. The rankings, they make sense. Makes it feel like a sport. It's a good job. Good thing to do.
Then we get Conan and Phoenix, and she doesn't. She wants Conan far away from Phoenix and Pentagon. So we'll see where this is going. But I don't know. It was a weird. I mean, I know I understood what they're doing, but it's still another weird kind of weird segment.
Yeah.
How it's presented.
Yeah, I'm with you. I felt like it was hard to completely follow what was going on because of the way it was presented.
But I did like the vignette they did for LA Park. I thought that was cool.
Mm-hmm. But you talk about going back to the 90s again. I mean, I know that he's over right now because he's the best wrestler in the world, according to certain people on the internet who also think that Zack Sabre Jr. is dog shit. So that feels like those two, those opinions seem to go hand in hand for some reason. I don't know exactly why. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Did you see the booking for LA Park? Should I spoil it? Who he's wrestling?
Oh, yeah, versus PCO.
Yeah, versus PCO. I hate to say it, but it feels like meme-rific booking. It feels like you're booking, like, the two meme guys who... You know, I mean, PCO is pretty good for what he's good for, but I don't think he's a good enough worker to carry someone like LA Park, who, realistically, I mean, the guy can barely move. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. I mean, the match could be fun. I think it's going to be a train wreck, and I think it's going to be... It's just going to depend on if it's an interesting train wreck or if it's just a sad old man train wreck.
Okay. I believe in LA Park. I don't think he's the best worker in the world, but I believe in what he can do, in what his strengths are.
Right.
Then we get an interview with Cade and Yuta. I thought they broke up already.
Yeah, me too.
So then now we have the official breakup where we get that. Cade actually attacks him.
Yeah, I always find that after you've had multiple chances to do the breakup angle, you know, where it has, like... It's in front of the crowd in the ring and feels like it has some real importance in affecting a match, that it's always better to completely overlook all of that and do the breakup angle in a backstage interview that no one's paying attention to.
Exactly. And on top of it, you talk about people talking about timing of booking angles and pulling the trigger. I thought this ship had sailed, so why are we even back here at it? So learn the timing, boys. And then we get Teddy Hart gets all angry at ACH and Swan. Yeah, I don't blame him. ACH can be annoying as fuck.
Yeah, right.
What about you?
Yeah, and, you know, Teddy Hart wants to be the only famous spousal abuser in wrestling, I guess, as part of the issues with Swan, maybe. I don't know. But either way, this shit is fucking... The Teddy Hart stuff is driving me crazy. I mean, did you watch the Battle Riot?
No, I did not.
Okay. Well, Teddy Hart eliminates himself from the Battle Riot, a la... who was it? Mil Mascaras. He kind of dumps off the top rope on his own to get himself eliminated. And then this stuff with the, like, shooty shoot bullshit, and it seems to primarily only be with ACH and Rich Swann, which I'll be fine with if it's some kind of angle to set up, like, a tag team partner, like Jack Evans coming in and doing, like, Teddy and Jack versus ACH and Swann. That could actually be kind of fun, but... Knowing MLW, instead of it being Jack Evans, they'll pick some random other flyer and they'll put him with him and they'll pretend like they're a tag team, you know, and then you know that they have some kind of history or connection when they.
Well, they are, they've already booked. Davey with him has the Hart Foundation. So.
Oh yeah, so there's that. Oh, okay, I forgot about that. So, I mean, that's fine. I guess the old new Hart Foundation can work. I guess. But yeah, we'll see. I'm not into the Teddy Hart stuff. Maybe once he actually starts wrestling and having matches, then it can maybe there could be something there. But as of right now, it feels like it's a lot of nothing.
Yeah, a lot of fluff and stuff. You know, they're building to a War Games match, and they actually get to use the term War Games. But so is NXT. In the next round, I think they're going to the War Games. How does that work? I mean,
yeah.
MLW has a copyrighted, so that's how they're able to use it. Do they just play nice because it's the WWE?
I guess it must be. I don't know. I mean, so there is a connection with Dusty, obviously, between MLW and Dusty.
Right.
So I don't know if they were able to get some kind of copyright thing from him. I don't think he owned the rights to anything, honestly.
I don't think
though.
He owned it. But no one copyrighted it. I think Bauer copyrighted it for himself.
Okay. Yeah, it seems weird. Maybe they're just letting them use it. Cause, I mean, if there became an intellectual property fight, I think that WWE would win because they have, through the lineage of owning WCW, they have the history of first use, you know, and they could show that they were them as a company, even if it was from owning a different company that no longer exists or absorbing another company, they have the history of using it first. So they could argue that they own it. So maybe MLW just allows them to use it because they don't want that headache of trying to fight with them. I don't know.
Right.
All right, and I guess if, okay, I just thought about it, but if they're doing a new Hart Foundation with Teddy and Bulldog, they can also have Pillman Jr. in there too, right? So they
can I think the booking was at Battle Riot, I think it was those two with Brian Pillman on the outside.
Ah, gotcha, okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and then we get Strickland versus Callahan. I thought they told a solid story. It wasn't, you know, amazing or anything, but told a story. What about you?
Yeah, these guys are good together, obviously, with the kind of the history that they have with each other, Sammy and Strickland. I don't know that Sammy trained Strickland from scratch, but he took him under his wing at a certain point. And so they have good back and forth, good action here, but it feels like... It doesn't feel like Sammy's coming up. It feels like Strickland's definitely going down. You know,
yeah,
and going from being the top guy to being in this match with Sammy felt like it's becoming a step down for Strickland. He's and it does also, like I said, question if he's on his way out, which sucks because he felt like a top star that they could bank on in the company, and now it feels like he's probably going to be gone or at least continuing to be de-emphasized moving forward. So, whatever, the match was fine. I'm with you. I think they told a story. Sammy looks good for once in a match, so. That's nice. Yeah, not bad stuff, but just I feel like MLW continues to be the promotion of like one step forward, two steps back. For every one thing that they do that I kind of like, or they're fixing angles, like you said with the Loki and Sammy Callahan stuff. At the same time, they do stuff like, you know, the Aria Blake stuff and the Teddy Hart stuff. You know, so it's one step forward, two steps back every time.
And I've yet to find anything I mean besides Lawler. There's nothing I really want to sink my teeth into, but I do believe in Tom Lawler, I will say that.
Yeah, and he's a guy that they could definitely focus and build around. And the Jake Hagar stuff could end up being interesting with Lawler and Hagar, but yeah, I think that Lawler, again, but I felt the same way a little bit with Strickland, like he was a guy that they could build around, and then what the fuck is going on? So hopefully they can stick with him and actually build around him for a little bit.
Yeah, and it sounds like Phoenix and Pentagon, they're WWE bound too next. So I don't know how long they are for MLW.
Yeah, because I had originally heard that Phoenix and Pentagon, there was no way that they were going to be Ebola this year, and then now they're showing up. So there's something going on with them. They're going to end up, I think, missing in action pretty soon here. Who knows exactly what's going on.
Now, but I did hear MLW did sign Strickland to a 2-year deal, so let's see how that plays out.
Okay. I mean, obviously, yeah. I talk about the mix-up between Evolve and MLW. It seems like a lot of cross kind of talent, a lot of people going back and forth, and Angle's very different.
You think about it, they're both, you know, worked Florida and New York, so.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're very similar companies at this point, so we'll see how they do, if they continue to play nice, or if they start having some issues.
Yep. All right, man, let's take a break, and we'll finish up into NXT.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaySpeedNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaySpeedNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and ahistoryofwrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaySpeedNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And we're back. We're back with NXT, and we opened up with Amber Nova versus Nikki Cross. What'd you think, man?
I thought it was good. Kind of. I thought that Amber Nova was kind of boring. But she was not like sloppy. She, you know, did a pretty good job at hitting her spots and all that, but I think Nikki Cross is, you know, I've said multiple times, I think Nikki Cross is one of the best wrestlers in NXT, so having like a kind of boring match with her is not a good sign, realistically. So I do kind of question that moving forward for her, but we'll see where they go. Heard a lot of people giving a lot of credit to kind of the way that everything is presented here on this show for the importance of the Mae Young Classic or whatever, but I don't necessarily know that I 100% saw that, especially even in this match here. Not necessarily like felt like this was a big deal coming out of this. But yeah, I mean, realistically, Nikki Cross was good at what she was doing. Everything Nikki Cross was doing felt good, but like I said, a little bit boring, and did not get super interested in the match at any point.
Speaking of Mae Young Classic, why do you think they released those so like behind the times?
I don't know, like why they don't just play it live, and people, I heard some people making big deals about that as well. I don't know. I mean, it seems like a weird move, right? To not just release it when everyone is like excited for it.
I can understand not doing it when they have a all women's pay per view. That's why, I mean, that's why I'm surprised they're running it right around the all women's pay per view.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point to say, like, you know, you've already got that in front of you, why would you even be kind of teasing something along the lines as like another all women's kind of show at the same time?
I mean, I understand connecting the two also, but who knows? Yeah, I'm not in that driver's seat, so I mean, who knows? Maybe because they want to spend extra time in post production. Who knows?
Right.
With the announce team and stuff. I mean, they have a green announce team, so that had something to do with it too, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
But then again, I really have no idea. Keith leaving yet? Hey, shows that he's a pretty good little talker. Good for him to dye his hair so he doesn't look so old. So I think that's a good thing. What about you? What'd you get come out of
there? Yeah, I'm with you on all that, both points. I'm impressed that he's debuting so early.
It's almost shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, I expected that to take longer, just with how long they take for so many guys to debut.
Hijack is an example.
Yeah, so that's obviously there's something there that they see that they're interested in. So yeah, moving forward, we'll see where they go. I mean, we see the debut match, which I also found interesting who he was up against.
Dieter Jr.
But good stuff all around, I thought. You know, good presentation, good. Yeah, so yeah, we'll see where this goes moving forward.
And then they put the Undisputed Era attack Ricochet, or they show Ricochet laid out with them laying, you know, standing over him. Here, Ricochet has some bumps, and this is a way of giving some time. That's not good for Ricochet so early in his career at the WWE, already having bumps, you know, being
kinda
in pain.
Kind of takes some time off, yeah.
Yeah, but it worked. Vanessa Bourne interview was fine. What about you? Do you think anything about it?
Yeah, I mean, fine is a great way to describe it, and she's someone who I was not high on before, so that's a plus for her that she's, you know, just having an okay kind of delivery here.
There's just so many women better on the roster. It's just, you know.
Yeah, and better at, you know, every part of the game, you know.
Yeah.
So it does make it makes it harder to get into her because she's subpar in a lot of ways.
Cassius Ohno versus Adrian whatever. What do you think of this?
Confusing.
Yeah.
I don't know what, you know, this guy, I think this is the guy who's married to Tenari Conti, so it was interesting that they're both kind of showing up on the same show when they don't show up on TV regularly, either of them. I thought that was odd. Didn't really know how I felt coming out of the match. I thought that they were, you know, they put Ohno over, but I do kind of question, like, what his positioning is, what they're doing with him. I was thinking about it as I was watching it, too, like, the comparison between Ohno and Samoa Joe, which is, like, I know, I mean, I guess it makes sense in a lot of ways, and it may not make sense in others, but it's like, what happened? Like, how did Samoa Joe go from, like, being brought in with, like, kind of under the guise of being the same thing as what Cassius Ohno is, and then ended up on the main roster being treated like a top-level guy, as opposed to Cassius, who's still here in NXT, being used in this way, where he's getting weird wins over underneath guys in NXT. I just was wondering about that, you know? It's like, is it the talking? But it's like, Cassius can talk, you know? So,
but
I don't know.
But we never really got to see that in the NXT level.
Yeah, that's probably part of it.
I think being Samoa helped Joe being a heavyweight.
I was going to say, too, I did kind of say that when I was thinking about it. It's like, part of it is probably because, like, they overlook him being fat because he's Samoan.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So,
I hate to say it, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, that seems to be it. I just find it interesting. It's like, what's the difference there? But this match itself was, yeah, like I said, I don't know what the fuck they were going for. Because this guy is nobody. They give him some token hope spots, which is probably mostly, you know, Chris Hero's style is he wants to get somebody over before he beats him, so
yeah,
it means something, which is smart, but it just, I just could not, like, really didn't get into it.
Yeah, I'm with you. Now, we get the EC3, Velveteen Dream, Poolside Summit. Part of me like this, then part of me is like, why are you teasing throwing him in a pool? Why do you make Velveteen Dream look like a dummy by thinking he was drowning in 3 foot of water? It was just weird, honestly. It was like they needed a comedy break in the show, and this is what they came up with. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, very similar feeling. I thought that the production on this was super weird. I liked the opening a little bit. It felt like there was a little bit of homoeroticism there. Ooh, this could...
there was.
I'm excited that this might go into, like, a weird psychosexual level where he's talking about, like, when I've been with you. It almost sounded like it was, like, kind of hinting at something there. But then it just turns into the pool dunk thing that was really dumb, and it all was shot really weirdly. I was kind of excited when it was first happening because I was like, oh, that's cool. They've never really done something like this in NXT. I thought it was going to be, like, a talk show kind of segment for... Velveteen Dream, but then it turned into this thing, and it was just kind of
weird. I was expecting something like 5 or 10 minutes, and this was pretty quick.
Yeah,
maybe they're leading to a pillow fight match, who knows.
That could be fun.
Who can hold their breath underwater the longest. Then we get the Keith Lee versus Marcel Bartel, Axel Dieter Jr. And that's Rick Martel's real... Oh, no, Rick Martel's fall brother was Pierre Martel. That's it. Okay. Big reaction to Lee.
Yeah, he's over.
Superstar pop. They're off and running. What did you think?
Yeah, the crowd's into him. Obviously, he's over. I thought that Bartel... I hope that they know what they have with Bartel because the size, the look... the poise that he carries himself with, he could be a star for them. I mean, he's really, in a lot of ways, he's, you know, he's the German Randy Orton. You know, if you were going to build a sports entertainer from the ground up, he'd look like Marcel Bartel. No, but yeah, he does, he's got the way his face looks, the way he carries himself, everything. So I just, as I'm watching it, it's like... Keith
size is a detriment, I mean, obviously.
For Bartel?
Yeah.
I mean, he's pretty tall. Like... if you see him here with Keith, he's about the same height. So,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't even realized how big he was because he spent so much time with Walter. But, I mean, you know, Walter's bigger than Keith. And
yeah, that's the whole thing is I always think of him next to him, you know?
Right. And so then when they're standing next to each other, I was like, damn, I didn't realize he was that tall. Like, he's about the same height. I'd have to look in to see exactly how tall he is. Keith felt a little off, I'm not gonna lie. The leapfrog, the dropkick was a little bit sloppier than I've seen him on the indies, but he's over and the crowd's into him. They let him keep most of his stuff, which I thought was interesting. I did not think Bask in His Glory was going to make it onto WWE TV just because of the kind of slightly blasphemous undertones of it. But yeah. Hey, whatever. You know, they're letting him do it. They're letting him do it. That's cool.
Then we got the Street Profits vignette / interview. Oof. This sucked again. Yes. They just stuck air out the TV, and nothing they do is good. What do you think?
It's fucking wild, man. I was like, I thought that the Snapchat stuff was bad. This is worse.
Yeah.
I was, like, impressed that they were able to fucking have, you know, doing a more normal style backstage promo thing, and it was way worse. Like, noticeably worse.
They're going to turn the Mighty back baby faces.
Yeah, exactly.
Because fucking Street Profits just are terrible. Then we get Vanessa Bourne versus Tanara Conti. What do you think of this?
This was, I thought, in a lot of ways better than the opening match, and in other ways a little bit sloppier. I thought that they told a good story, really, in the ring. Tanara Conti was working really, really hard. She was super aggressive. And then Vanessa Bourne was being kind of trying to be snidely and cheat, but also overpowering her. Using her kind of size advantage and a couple, you know, underhanded tactics. Not even underhanded tactics, but kind of being a little bit more roughneck and going against, like, the, I guess you would say, like, the spirit of sportsmanship. So, yeah, good stuff. I thought the finish with Conti almost crying about going into the Mae Young Classic was good. But then also, did they not start out saying that she was in it last year? So it feels like why is she going so over the top about being in it again when she was in it last year? But, you know, whatever. I guess they're trying to, again, they're trying to put it over. But it's just when I came into this and I was told that, you know, oh, they did such a good job of making the Mae Young Classic feel important with these qualifiers. And then the first match I felt like was not very good. And then the second match, or the second one, it felt like, why are both of these girls were in it before and they're going over the top of being in it again? It just, all of it feels rings a little bit too hollow for me.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Then we get a Black vs. Gargano, which is just a teaser because Aleister Black's hurt, and this is going to be the main event for the pay-per-view, or the special, whatever you want to call it. So we just got a few minutes. We're not going to really go into it because it's just a few minutes, but I hear something. I heard Meltzer was trying to pass the idea of how about throw Lee or Matt Riddle in the main event and have them win it, and they'd be over immediately. What do you think about that?
I mean, sure, they would. But it's not like, I don't know if that moves the needle or does anything. You know what I mean? And it's, and like, what's the point?
And does it ruin their storytelling they've been playing?
Right. And does it extend Ciampa Gargano, which is already getting to the point where it's kind of stale? I think you need to have a blow-off between those two. You should probably just let it happen naturally with the title. And send one of them up to the main roster. You know what I mean? So
Ciampa Gargano at this point feels like 4-day-old salmon in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we're gonna get a great match. Don't get me wrong, but it's like time to move on.
I was really happy when Ciampa was turning to focus on Black and won the title, but then knowing that it's going back to more Gargano Ciampa stuff, I felt like, god damn, like I really thought they were getting away from it for at least a while. You know,
And in fact, we're kind of like, Black's kind of lucky he got hurt here, because you know what, he would have been looked like the third man, or the also ran in a title match, in his title match,
right? I mean,
or
I
now he lost it, but he lost it because he got hurt.
I could see them trying to do something more like, if you compare it to like the three-way ECW title match where Taz was leaving the company, and they made the three-way that was between Mike Awesome and Masato Tanaka, who already had like a history of having a feud with each other, and then you turn around and have, you know, you throw the tag team, or you throw the champion into it, he's eliminated first, and then the other guys who have an issue with each other go at it. That worked, but I think throwing Riddle into the feud that already exists is the backwards, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't think that works as well. If you did it the same way,
he might even look like less of a star, where he gets less reactions to Gargano and Ciampa, which I don't know would happen, but it could happen.
Yeah, you don't know that that would happen, but I think that the storytelling that's clunky and doesn't work as smoothly. I think if you have what it is that the champion's leaving, he ends up getting interjected into a feud that already exists, and then somehow that makes him lose the title, which is similar to what happened with Black, except for it wasn't a three-way. You know, he got thrown in the middle of the feud between Gargano and Ciampa, he loses the belt. I think you throw another guy in there who's like a third party, then it feels like coming out of it, now what you have is you have the new champion, which let's say it's Riddle, and then you have the other two guys that were in the match. They're going to continue their feud that I think the point we need to get to is getting that feud over with. So we need to just have the blow off. And, you know, I don't think throwing a third person in there helps with that blow off. It's a really weird thing to have brought up and mentioned. And especially because, like you said, it would get them over. I'm like, okay, Keith Lee was already over when he debuted here. And I don't think there's going to be an issue with Riddle being over. So I don't think it moves the needle in overness for either one of them. I don't think it makes people more excited about the NXT Championship in any way. So it just seems like such a weird kind of, you know, swerve or booking idea for the sake of having an idea thing. When what you're probably better off having is just having the title match, making a clear winner. Whoever loses gets the fuck out of here, goes to the main roster, goes to 205 Live, whatever. And then you can move forward with whatever's next.
All right, man. Anything you want to talk about before we head out?
I just thought that was interesting that they did another like kind of teased match that didn't deliver after they had already done that with Ricochet earlier in the same episode. I found that interesting. But I did like Regal coming out because they've saved that enough. And you talked about the rule of diminishing returns. They've protected that enough to where Regal showing up is a big deal now because he actually comes out in front of the crowd and that's a big deal. So
yeah, felt good. He's been hurt. Yeah, he's been sick. Yeah.
So, and then what I did like was a nice callback that was maybe more of an Easter egg or just a notice thing. But when Regal came out and he announced the women's fatal four-way match for the NXT title that was on TakeOver a while back, that was like Charlotte, Becky, Sasha, and Bayley. They were all on the ramp like that, and when he announced it, Sasha screamed and shouted and said it wasn't fair, and the same thing happened here with Tommaso Ciampa saying it's not fair when he said that he was making it into a three-way. So I thought that was a nice little nod to the history of NXT. I liked that. Otherwise, big picture stuff. Follow me on Twitter at Lucha Undead. And that's it for me. What about you, Pete?
Yeah, I'll be going to Action Wrestling in October, so
looks like it was in Atlanta. Huh? Yeah, looks like a real good card so far.
Yeah, so far. I mean, they still have a lot to announce, but, you know, they have an August one coming, and then I'm going to be there in late October. Inspire Pro looks like they're running one hell of a card. September, I think it's 3rd or 2nd or whatever. Maybe whatever it is. Freaking MJF versus ACH. Andy Dalton versus PCO. Ricky Starks versus Sammy Guevara. And Terrell Tempo versus, I can't remember now off the top of my head, but so far, three matches I'm super excited for. Tempo is always hit or miss with me, but the three, those three announced are, any one of them could be the show stealer, and I think ACH works well, as a babyface versus MGF. PCO and Dalton should be fun. And Sammy Guevara and Ricky Starks should be very good because they've wrestled before and they've had great matches. So, and follow me at Titans of Wrestling. Have a great week and keep on watching the wrestling. We'll see you later.
礼を許したよ。そして見ても